and consider how we might approach these things differently and make our world a better place. So join me, Ben Ansell, for a new series of Rethink on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this Thursday afternoon at 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 14th of September. This is Chris Aldridge. Good morning. Sir Keir Starmer says he held wide-ranging and productive talks with President Biden about Ukraine, but wouldn't say whether he'd persuaded the US to allow Kyiv to fire Western missiles into Russia. The Prime Minister said the talks at the White House concentrated on strategy rather than a particular step or tactic. President Biden said it was clear that Putin would not prevail. Our political editor Chris Mason travelled with the Prime Minister to the White House.
The UK has been forward-facing, as it was put to me, in making the case to others to agree to Kyiv's request to be allowed to fire Western missiles into Russia. President Biden is sceptical, fearful it could drag America and Europe into direct conflict with Moscow. There was little expectation this meeting would resolve the issue, not least because further conversations with others at the United Nations are expected shortly. Defeating Russia while not provoking Moscow, the essence of the West's challenge since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2.5 years ago.
Analysis carried out for the government of its planned cut to winter fuel payments in England and Wales has revealed that more than 750,000 pensioners are not expected to claim the benefit, even though they're entitled to it. The Equalities analysis produced for the Department for Work and Pensions also showed that people over 80 will lose the most financially. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has more details of the review.
It suggests that around 100,000 more people could be persuaded to claim pension credit and therefore retain the winter fuel payment. But more than 750,000 pensioners who are eligible are still not expected to submit a claim and would therefore lose the payment. The analysis also suggests that the over 80s would lose the most financially. A Treasury spokesman said more than 1 million pensioners would still receive the payment this winter, and the focus was now on ensuring that those who should be claiming it would receive it.
The former chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch and his British partner are facing more allegations they sexually exploited men at events they hosted around the world. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith are already defending a civil lawsuit alleging they ran a sex trafficking operation. Last year, the BBC revealed a middleman had been tasked with finding men for these events. Here's our investigations correspondent, Rhianna Croxford.
The BBC has now spoken to 20 men who say they attended or helped organise sex events for Mike Jeffries. These took place from 2009 until 2015, while he was chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch. The new allegations come from men who say they felt exploited and abused. The FBI has been investigating since the BBC first revealed allegations against Mr. Jeffries last year. He is already facing a civil lawsuit over allegations of sex trafficking. A lawyer for Mr. Jeffries, who retired in 2014, has previously said he denied allegations of wrongdoing. Mr. Smith has never responded to requests for comment.
One of England's largest school academy trusts is set to become the first of its size to ban students from using mobile phones at school. Ormiston Academies Trust says it's phasing out access to smartphones for around 35,000 pupils at its 44 state schools. The Westminster government has said it won't fund the redevelopment of a stadium in Belfast in time for the 2028 European Football Championships. Without Casement Park, it's likely that Northern Ireland will be the only UK nation not to host matches during the tournament. Two NASA astronauts, whose eight-day mission is now set to last 8 months because of technical problems, have admitted they faced tough times. Barry Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams couldn't use the Boeing Starliner capsule to return from the International Space Station last week because it developed a malfunction. During a news conference, Butch Wilmore insisted they didn't feel let down, even though they now won't be able to come back until February.
We found some things that we just could not get comfortable with. We could have gotten to the point, I believe, where we could have returned on Starliner, but we just simply ran out of time.
That's Butch Wilmore ending this section of BBC News. Now let's turn to the weekend weather. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Chris. Good morning. Quite a chilly start for some of us in the south, but we have got some warmer air pushing across the UK over the next few days, so temperatures are going to be on the up, but still some rain and some wind in the north, especially today. So for England and Wales, a little bit of patchy drizzle around in the north this morning, where it's fairly cloudy too. Further south, we've got those clear skies from the word go. Any drizzly rain should peter out, and then we're going to see long spells of sunshine for many areas. Just a bit of cloud drifting around, though, across northern England and Wales. But top temperatures somewhere between about 17 to 20 degrees. It will feel breezy for northern England, though. Scotland and Northern Ireland, a bit of drizzle in the west, quite a cloudy day. It's also going to be windy for Scotland and Northern Ireland, gusts up to about 40, even 50 miles an hour in the northwest. More persistent rain will work in from the west during this afternoon, initially across Northern Ireland, then into the western half of Scotland. Eastern Scotland dry for much of the day, and highs around 16 to 18 degrees today.
Thank you, Sarah. A look at the papers now. Both the Times and the Mail lead with President Zelensky's renewed plea to the West to allow Ukraine to fire British missiles into Russian territory. The Mail says he's accusing the West of dithering while Russian forces burn down cities and villages in Ukraine. The Telegraph's lead features detail from the autobiography of Lord Brady, the former chairman of the Conservative 1922 Committee, which runs the selection process for new Tory leaders. The paper says his book, Kingmaker, details his private conversations with them as they were being forced from power. The Telegraph says Lord Brady reveals that Rishi Sunak was not facing a confidence vote when he called the election, that Lord Cameron and George Osborne had contempt for people who did not share their backgrounds, and that Boris Johnson was fed up with backbenchers criticising his adviser, Dominic Cummings, during the pandemic. A Tear for Sven is the headline in the Mirror. It carries photos of the funeral of the former England football manager Sven-Göran Eriksson, where an emotional David Beckham was among the mourners yesterday in Sweden. The pictures show him wiping his eyes and comforting Sven's former partner, Nancy Dell'Olio. The I paper reports that more of us are using private healthcare than ever before because of the length of NHS waiting lists, with the number of admissions to private hospitals hitting a record high so far this year. The Guardian suggests that universities would do well to keep an eye on their local team's football results. It reports a study has found that institutions in areas with successful sides may be more attractive for prospective students. But universities where clubs struggle can experience a reduction in application numbers. With warnings of a deepening financial crisis in the higher education sector, the paper suggests the vice-chancellors should don their local team's scarf and hope they avoid the drop. And that's our look at the papers. More in the Today programme from 7 o'clock. Now on Radio 4, John Gowers on the west coast of Wales with Open Country.
Here we are on the edge of the picturesque harbour of Aberaeron. Aber, meaning estuary, Aeron, the river that funnels into the sea here. There's a bit of building work going on. In fact, there's millions of pounds worth of building work going on here because of the challenges the sea poses to the place. But the sea has also been bountiful and looked after the place because it's provided work in shipbuilding, in fishing, and now tourism. And at this point of the year, they celebrate one little aspect of the sea's bounty, being the mackerel. And we're here for the Mackerel Festival, which is a fishy story in itself. Well, it's 5 minutes to go before the festival parade begins in Aberaeron. The streets are properly lined, they're packed with people. There's a sort of expectant hush because soon that's about to be broken by the sound of the crazy beach buggy car decorated with all the creatures of the sea. Behind that is the adamant jazz band. Behind that again, you've got these women dressed in black with black masks and so on, and they're the Wailing Widows. I haven't even seen the mackerel yet, and I already know it's very substantial, verging on gargantuan.
My name is Myrick Jones, and I lived in Aberaeron for about 45 years. We moved to Spain about 7 years ago now, but we come back every year, and especially to take part in the Mackerel Festival.
You come back to take part in the Mackerel Festival because you dreamt it up, didn't you?
Yes, many point the finger and blame me, and some congratulate me. It started off as a bit of fun. It was based on sardine festivals that many other countries did, but we don't get sardines here. It was either herring or mackerel, and mackerel seemed to be a more colourful creature to dress up as and celebrate.
So, along with some friends, you're sitting around, I presume it was of an evening. I don't know, presumably of an evening.
The bar was involved.
There were some libations, and then you come up with this idea of a mackerel festival based on the sardine festivals, which are celebrations of the sea giving up its bounty. All of those things need a good ritual as well, and you've managed to build a ritual into this.
Yes, I'm not quite sure exactly how it evolved, but either myself or one of us decided we were going to build a giant mackerel. So the mackerel is usually about 23 foot long, and it's carried by 6 pallbearers through the town, up the main road, and over to the south side of the harbour. Just about every year, the Reverend Dilwyn Jones has given a blessing to the mackerel and to conservation in general. And then at dusk, traditionally, the mackerel is burnt on the beach, returned to the sea.
So you dreamt the festival into being. You've also made the giant mackerel, but not satisfied with that, you decided to go one step further and create a little legend you could weave into the whole thing.
Well, I think if you're going to create a tradition, it has to have something behind it. Often I got stopped and say, yeah, but why are you doing this? And I say, well, it's tradition, tradition. Yeah, but what's the tradition? So, yes, I thought there was no harm in creating a little legend behind it. The Chronicles of Idwell appeared, giving a story behind it. But it also emphasised that the fishing industry goes back to the times of the monks in Strata, Florida. Just a mile or so up the coast from Aberaeron itself, you can see on a very low tide the remains of old fish traps that the monks used to spend time there gathering for their livelihoods, which they would salt them, they would smoke them. And it seemed nice or appropriate to incorporate that into it. At least it's a bit of fact behind some fiction.
I don't want to rain on your mackerel-themed parade, Myrig, but there is a sadness, though, in the sense that the mackerel don't shoal and aren't here in as much abundance as they used to be.
You're quite correct, and I think it's something that concerns all of us. The Reverend Dilwyn Jones goes on, sometimes at length, on his blessing on the mackerel, but he is very keen to point out to all of us the importance of conservation and taking care in what we do, and no matter how small an effort it is, to help the sort of proliferation of these fish and all sea life. It is in general a celebration of all sea creatures.
Well, I overheard people, two ladies on the bus today, they were coming here. It's now an event. They come here in the same way that on Bank Holiday Monday they come to the carnival. It's become a celebration of summer, of place as well, because the place exists because of its connections with the sea.
Aberaeron was built specifically as a harbour town. Fishing was obviously an integral part of having a harbour here. And when the idea was coined, it wasn't just an idea for a big party, but I had a business in town here for a few years. I've lived here for a long time. I felt I wanted to do something that would help, if you like, tourism, help attract people, extend the holiday season. The businesses here, they depend wholly on the tourist trade. And I thought a little contribution towards amusing visitors. It was several ideas in one that inspired us.
It must be nice, though, to come back at the right time of year to see the festival you helped to dream into being.
Yeah, I'm delighted, absolutely delighted, that they've carried on the tradition. When we started off, It was difficult to convince six people to make idiots of themselves by dressing up with black shirts with mackerel ties, top hats, and be pallbearers, and to have a crowd behind of wailing widows to mourn the end of the season, the departure of the mackerel. I'm taking part myself again today. I've been roped in as a pallbearer. It's nice that it's hit other people's imagination, and we've had letters and inquiries from all over the world, and we've had people visiting this from all over the world.
The idea then of the wheeling widows, how many drinks in were you when you came up with that?
Oh, it was progressive throughout the night. The ideas seemed to flow better.
So we've now fallen in step behind the wheeling widows. And if they are bemoaning the end of the mackerel season, there seems to be a lot of genuine emotion about it. They're dressed like grief itself, really. All in black. There are four of you gathered here. Could you just introduce yourselves?
I'm Matilda.
I'm Beth.
Rachel.
Janice.
Now, you walk behind, or with the mackerel, to bemoan something, yeah? Something is lost, something is absent.
We're mourning the end of the mackerel season, so we cry.
You cry because it's come to the end. So I suppose the end of the mackerel season is also the end of summer, isn't it?
Yes.
In the old days, mackerel would come in here and there'd be loads of them. You know, loads of people would be having mackerel for tea. That's gone now because the sea doesn't have the same bounty of fish, does it?
I remember 40-odd years ago there being fishing boats moored just down here in the harbour, but haven't seen them for a while now.
You've got a very lovely black feather adorning your mask there.
First year for me to have my own mask.
Your own mask? You've graduated this year, okay.
I have, yes.
So do you just like reach deep inside to find your saddest place? Is that how it
works? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got to be as loud as possible.
Yeah, loud as possible, as sad as possible, as grieving as possible. If I gave you a countdown from 3, 2, 1, go, might you be able to do it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can come to the Mackerel Festival at Aberoeron and hear an awful lot about fish stocks dwindling or disappearing, but what you really need is a fisherman who knows what's going on out there. Tim Archer, you are a fisherman. Tell me about mackerel and how they're faring out there in the Irish Sea, in Cardigan Bay.
I would say that certainly since I've been fishing here, it's close to the worst year we've had. Last year was a strange year. We caught a lot of what they call joeys, which are very small mackerel, but not buckets full as we'd sort of been used to in years gone by.
I remember meeting a herring fisherman who was up on the Llyn Peninsula on the northwestern arm of Cardigan Bay, and he used to go out catching mackerel and herring, and he'd be hauling them in, and his arms would get tired. And then when I asked him to describe the situation now, he said, it's like the Dead Sea out there. We pollute the sea, we discard plastic into the sea, we dump all sorts of chemicals in the sea, and on top of that, of course, we still have industrial fishing, we still have scallop fishing taking up the seabed. So the sea's expected to take a lot of punishment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But in a way, we're sort of slightly fortunate here because, you know, we're right in the middle of Cardigan Bay. There's very, very limited fishing. This year, I think, is the first year that absolutely no commercial fishermen fish out of Aberaeron. The only fisherman here has moved away from the town. Possibly elements of that are to do with the sea defence works. I'm not absolutely sure. But there are far fewer boats going out fishing from the town at the moment.
You can sometimes get a bit depressed listening to all the changes in the natural world, but today isn't about being depressed. This is a day of celebration, and there's a fantastic feel-good factor spreading all over Aberoeron today, isn't there?
Absolutely fantastic. You know, and given that the, you know, the future of the town, the work that they're doing on the sea defences. You know, it's the whole town looking 20, 40, 60 years ahead. And it's not quite as it normally is at this time of year, being surrounded by what effectively is, you know, a lot of rocks, a breakwater being built, but there's still a fantastic feel in the town. So you're absolutely right. It's a joy to be around.
Well, hyfryd eich gweld, Eleanor Gwilym, lovely to see you. Eleanor Gwilym, you're a member of the Aberaeron Society. You have a deep interest in the history of this place. Today, allowing for the fact that there's some building working on, it's a picturesque little harbour, but historically this was also a shipbuilding factory, I suppose.
Yes, it was a small creek to start with where boats went out and caught herring. And then money was given by a local squire who invested it in building the harbour. And of course, the harbour was somewhere that a lot of ships could come into.
So here are the ships built in Aberaeron. And some are personal names. So we've got Eleanor, John and Henry.
Yeah.
Then there are place names like Andy's, Ganges, Iron Vale, the Gracian Iron Vale, but some of them are abstract terms like diligence and economy. And
there's Gambia.
There's Gambia, yes. I like this one here.
Gowerian, yeah.
That's John Gower. I like the name of that ship. That's a very excellent one, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Some of these other names, look, Puella, Feronia, yeah. Ironian.
Yeah, there's a house called Puella. He was a captain, so Mrs. Lloyd Puella, she lived till she was 103. The name of the house still stays there.
And of course, you have a sense of the scale of them as well, because the sloop is 49 tonnes, but then the much larger schooner is 86 tonnes. And then a smack, and it sounds small, doesn't it? A smack is a small, and there's 25 tonnes.
Yeah.
So you get a sense of quite a range of smaller, livelier craft. And when I say lively, there's one actually called Lively Lass.
Yeah. There was a lot of trade with Bristol here, because the farmers used to be bring the products in from the countryside, and the products went to Bristol and around the coast.
But there were also people trading with countries far away.
Absolutely. So if you go around the town, you will find houses with names. I mean, where I live is Riversdale, named after a ship, but you'll also find a house called Madras. There is one along Bellevue Terrace called Brooklyn. We've also got a Moldavia. If you'd like to see a picture of my great-grandfather on my mother's side, he's on board ship there, and that picture was taken in Alexandria in Egypt, and he travelled all around the world, like many did from this area.
I always like to look at photographs in this period because they make me feel as if I don't have sufficient testosterone, because they all have these lovely bushy moustaches and there's that grand beard and so on. And of course, pith helmets.
He's wearing a pith helmet and he's in his whites, yes. And my great-grandfather's father, John Thomas, drowned in Biddeford. He was on a schooner and his wife was left as a widow. And she had children, and what happened was the town got together and they printed these little cards and went round and asked people to give money towards the bereaved widow and her son.
And there was a tradition of this, wasn't it? It was almost like the Mutual Benefit Society later on, where people would come back and realise that there was no one anymore to look after the family, so the community did.
Yes, absolutely. So her son then was my great-grandfather, who went on to follow in his father's trade and sail around the world. There's one little other story I can tell you. My great-grandfather went to Cape Verde, and when he was in Cape Verde, they were sailing away from Cape Verde, and a young man jumped into the sea and followed the ship. They brought him on the ship. He was called Marcus Antonius, and he came to Aberaeron they naturalised him. My great-grandfather and one of the tradesmen in the area sort of signed the papers to naturalise him. He then became known as Mark Antony, married a woman from Llandrystid, had three children. He unfortunately died abroad when he went back sailing, but his wife and family stayed in Aberaeron.
There's a whole story just there, isn't there? When you look at it, it's fascinating. So, you're saying about your own house, which is obviously sort of steeped in maritime history. When we look around here, you can sort of tell in the architecture of a place like Aberaeron the history of the sort of hierarchies of the sea, because you can tell who owned the ship building, who were the captains and so on. Where the harbour master lived, was the harbour master's house and office?
Yeah, the harbour master, it's now called the Harbour Master Hotel. It was the Red Lion going back in time. And when we talk about the Red Lion, there used to be about 30, 40 public houses in the town. And the public houses would have been in those little houses. They were served beer in the little front room. So that you can imagine a load of sailors coming back in, the workmen in the shipyards. It was quite a big business, just a little house where you could go in and have a jar of beer.
There was a busy mercantile shipbuilding, fishing, trading a history, and that changed, and we've seen sort of fishing change as well. Herring was the silver currency of the Irish Sea.
Absolutely.
When you look at Aberaeron now, it's still thriving and bustling, and yesterday, Mackerel Festival is a joyous occasion, and that's in the nature of places like this. Harbours change almost more than anywhere.
Yes, absolutely. There was a fishing family here, the Jenkins family, six brothers, and they used to go out and trade mackerel. And in fact, the descendants of that family had a fish shop here until not long ago. But now we have fish coming into town via a van from New Quay. Interestingly, of these six brothers, the last one to pass away was Meredith Jenkins. And Meredith passed away, his coffin had a little miniature mackerel alongside.
Please, the Reverend Dilwyn Jones. Thank you very much. He's forgotten his glasses.
The Mackerel Festival is held annually in Aberaeron, and the event has grown over the years to be quite popular. It marks the end of the mackerel fishing and also the end of the summer season. Unfortunately, the summer season was very, very disappointing this year, with unsettled weather and very little sunshine. The supply of mackerel was scarce, and most of the boats were unable to leave the harbour because of the major works that is taking place at the moment around the harbour and the town. This year, we have to divert our attention from the mackerel to other issues that are important. The sea, as you know, is a powerful agent, and nothing can withstand its force. We are reminded in Psalm 89, "You rule over the surging sea. When the waves mount up, you still them."
So the Reverend Dilwyn Jones, you're not exactly a new arrival in Aberaeron. You've been here a while now, haven't you? And you've seen this grow. This is a happy day, isn't it? It's a happy occasion.
Oh, yeah, well, that's what it is. The blessing of the mackerel, really, is very little as far as the crowd is concerned. It is an opportunity to display some kind of message and to make people think. That's the purpose. Well, that's the purpose of any sermon. If you can make people think, well, then you're halfway there.
Normally, you like to do a longer sermon, don't you? That was the condensed version today.
Oh, very much so. They wouldn't like it too long. No, that is true. I get it very short today.
Yeah, because the tradition in Wales is that the minister usually gets full of hoyle.
Yes.
And the sermon can go on until hours, can't it?
Those days are gone, unfortunately, no.
You were saying about how religion has changed in Wales. We used to be one of the most religious countries on earth, and we very quickly became one of the most secular countries on earth. The same is true for fishing. We had a time of great abundance, and we've seen this great dwindling. But even though we're celebrating the end of the season, we're also on about something, which is about things disappearing, aren't we?
Well, that is true, but the mackerel stocks for the last couple of years have really gone down. We used to have plenty. I never used to buy them, because most of the people who took the boats out to the sea, they would give them to you.
Well, they'd never charge you, would they?
No, well, I don't know about that. I asked Winston Evans, which is a popular fisherman in New Quay, and I said, what about the mackerel? I said, I haven't had one myself yet.
You mean Winston Evans can't even get one for you, Dylan, a man of your authority?
Exactly. And he didn't have any himself.
There's something miserably wrong, is there? Yeah. Well, diolch yn fawr iawn I chi. Thank you very much indeed.
No problem. As the season comes to its close, we know that your providence will continue. The heavens proclaim your glory, the earth your power, the sea your might, and all your creatures your bounty. We rejoice in the order and goodness of your abundance, so that we and all will benefit and enjoy. And we ask all these in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. You may now feel free and enjoy yourselves.
That's a good sound. Open Country was presented by John Gower and produced by Eliza Lomas in Bristol. Next week, young carers spend a night under the stars in Dartmoor.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV Licence Uni.
This is BBC Radio 4. Now it's time for Farming Today This Week with Kaz Graham.
Good morning. Today, underspending.
It is slightly worrying times for especially us as a younger generation trying to get into farming.
Overfishing?
To our mind, that is stupid. It is destroying the future.
And dodging the man in the middle.
You know, when you see a farmer looking and thinking, bye, £75, I'll have a go at that.
But first, one of the last big agricultural shows of the year, the Westmorland County Show, took place in Cumbria this week. With 300 cattle and 1,500 sheep on show from all across the UK, I took the opportunity to go and take a look. I have made my way across the show field to a tent that has 4 pens of different breeds of sheep in them. And there's a lot of young farmers all gathered around here. Robbie Chewer from Cumbria Young Farmers. What is going on here today?
Well, today we are hosting the Five Nations YFC Stock Judging Final. So England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland are all competing here. They are judging sheep, they are judging breeding yows, they are judging butcher's lambs. We will go into the main ring later on and we are judging for dairy cattle and for beef animals as well. And then the points are accumulated and the overall nation is ultimately the winner.
And in this judging, what are they looking for?
Stocksmanship is the absolute key to every farmer's success. So whether they are looking at a dairy cow in a ring to go into their milking herd, or whether they are selecting butcher's lambs to go to the butcher, they are doing a lot on eye.
Well, look, we have got two young women judging already in this particular pen. And if I have a look at the front of your very posh showing white coat, you are Gwen YFC.
Yeah, I'm Neris. I'm from Gwen, here as part of Team Wales.
Okay, and you are?
I'm Lynedd, and I'm from Carmarthenshire as part of Team Wales.
Okay, just getting a hold of one of these sheep now.
Yeah.
You've got it, its head. What are you doing?
I'm checking how many teeth she's got, so then you'll be able to tell the age of the ewe. But yeah, you want a good long ewe, deep body, plenty of power with a leg in each corner.
This one's looking at you in a really sort of curious way. Is that important, that kind of like zest for life and curiosity?
You want to know what's going to catch your eye, really. You don't want something that stands in the back of the pen and doesn't have that appeal to it.
What do you reckon? I mean, are they good?
They're pretty good. The one I just felt then is very wide. And like the wider she is in the loin, hopefully she'll pass that on to the lamb, and the lamb will have a good loin, and that's where your chops are and everything like that, so your higher price cuts.
This is an international competition. How competitive do you think it's going to be?
Oh, I think it'll be quite competitive. The standard of competitors here today, I think, is phenomenal.
Well, good luck.
Brilliant. Thank you.
And we've more from the Westmorland County Show a little later in the programme. The Committee of MPs, which scrutinises environment and agriculture policy, has a new chair. The Liberal Democrat MP, Alistair Carmichael, who's represented Orkney and Shetland for 23 years, says the committee's to-do list is substantial. Mr Carmichael was the only candidate for chairing the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Select Committee, commonly known as EFRA. He told Charlotte Smith why he wanted the job.
I come from a farming family, and over the years I've had the opportunity to see how government can do things well and the difference they can make, and how sometimes getting something just even slightly wrong can have such a catastrophic impact on our smaller rural communities. And at a moment like this, I think this is a really important time. We're going to be setting the agenda for years to come. Having the chance to influence that is something that I absolutely relish.
Because of the way the system works, it had to be a Liberal Democrat MP this time to chair the committee. Nobody else put themselves forward. Is this a stitch-up? Or did nobody else realise the importance of this job?
No, Luke, there's no stitch-ups in these things, trust me. There are other people in the party who could have done the job. Tim Farn, Sarah Dyke, to mention just but two. But, you know, their preference was not to do it. I'm keen to do it. And I'm raring to get going now.
Now, you are MP for Orkney and Shetland. Agriculture is devolved. So a lot of what you will be discussing will have no bearing whatsoever on your constituents. So why bother?
A lot of it is devolved, but a lot of it actually has quite significant and profound cross-border implications. So just even the amount of money that there is to go into agricultural support payments, for example, is something that is decided by Treasury and DEFRA in the United Kingdom Parliament. Remember, Luke, I am a chair of a committee. There are other members who will be appointed from other parts of the country and other political parties as well. And as soon as I've got the committee appointed and we're all up and running, I'm going to be working them, because right at the moment, I'm a bit like a child in a sweetie shop. Everywhere I look, I see some issue relating to food production, farming communities, rural communities, fishing communities. These are all things that will need early scrutiny.
That's the new EFRA committee chair, Alistair Carmichael. The UK fishing industry is renewing its calls for the government to develop a fishing strategy. It comes as negotiations with the EU and Norway get underway over what and how much UK fishing crews can catch. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from the Blue Marine Foundation charity, which says that current quotas allow for fishing above the level suggested by scientific advice from ICES. That's the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea. But first, Charlotte Smith spoke to Mike Cohen, Chief Executive of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations.
We have a national energy strategy that has made offshore energy production a key plank of what it proposes. We have a marine conservation strategy that determines percentages of the seabed to be reserved for conservation purposes, but we don't have a strategy for producing food there. If we don't do that, then we'll quickly find that we have constantly assumed that fishing will take place in whatever space we leave for it. And that's a real mistake to make. We need to think now about what we want our fishing industry to be able to achieve. Its contribution to food security, to jobs in coastal communities. We can't assume it will always just manage.
We have, over the past quite a few years, really, seen a decline in the number of vessels registered here in the UK. If you get a strategy, does that honestly make any difference to that gradual decline?
I think it does. I think fleets change and working practices change, and we have an ageing workforce, much as farming does, and that's an issue for us. But never mind thinking about decline, I think we can do more, particularly if government turns its eye towards our relations with our neighbours that we share waters and share stocks with.
Well, the last government made much of the agreement that it got late last year with the EU and Norway, giving increases, it said, in access to stocks for British fishermen. How's that deal working out as we go into the negotiations for the next one?
So we have these deals every year. This is a really important time of year for us when we negotiate with our neighbours, and every year there are changes to things. I think last year was really characterised by a failure to reach a workable deal on pollock, which was devastating for fishermen in the southwest. We'd like to see government this year negotiating robustly with the EU and Norway and others over properly, scientifically backed, allowable catches and quotas for the stocks that we depend on. And that doesn't mean...
Well, this is where it gets difficult, though, isn't it? Because there are plenty of people who will say, well, hang on, we're already overfishing by some measurements. We need to actually think about this in a different way.
Well, I would agree with you. We do need to think about this in a different way, because the people who claim we're overfishing are looking at this in an incredibly narrow way. It's very disingenuous, some of these calls that come in. We look at the data we get from ICES, and we have calls to stop fishing because stocks are not immediately in perfect status. ICES does not tell us how to fish. ICES gives advice. It gives advice on how we could get a certain fish stock into a perfect status in the next 12 months, which is what people tend to leap on and say, you're overfishing. It won't be perfect in the next year. You must stop at once. ICES will also tell you what level you should fish at if you want to make everything perfect in, let's say, the next 3 years. And very often that involves changing very, very little, because we have management plans in place for these stocks and they're already on a very solid trajectory towards very good status. My objective as someone representing the fishing industry is not to run a zoo. My objective is not to have the greatest possible number of fish in the sea. My objective is to have plenty of fish in the sea so that we can keep on producing food for people from them 100 years from now and further. That doesn't mean closing things down right now, putting fishing businesses out of business, because once we close them down, we'll never get them back again.
Mike Cohen from the NFFO. Well, a conservation charity, the Blue Marine Foundation, has launched legal proceedings over the previous government's decision to set fishing levels on multiple UK stocks above the level suggested by scientific advice. It believes that the decision was illegal under post-Brexit fishing law, which requires that management of UK fisheries is based on the best available scientific advice. Anna Hill spoke to its co-founder, Charles Clover.
At the top level, we are overfishing our waters. Now, this is a surprise because we invented our own post-Brexit Fisheries Act, which is meant to prevent that. But we are actually handing out fishing opportunities above scientific advice for 54% of the 70-odd stocks that are fished. And to our mind, that is stupid. We're waiting to see if the new government decides to take different decisions to the last government.
We heard from the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations. They said that concerns around overfishing are disingenuous because stocks are growing, maybe not as fast as they could, but they say fishing is sustainable at the moment.
That isn't a picture that I find recognisable. Let me take Celtic sea cod. The government and the EU handed out a quota that is the same or slightly larger than the entire adult spawning population this year. Now, that is an appalling thing to do. And this stock has gone down by 90%. So what the fishing industry are saying doesn't really make much sense to me.
These arguments, you know, pushing and pulling, the tension between the two, have been going on for decades, haven't they? So is there a solution? What sort of policy combined with the need of fishermen can be drawn up to make things work better?
Well, we've never had a policy. Let's just make that clear. We've never had a strategy for what we should fish and what we should not fish in this country. We've allowed everybody to have a go at everything all the time.
So, and that's what the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations is asking for, a strategy, a fishing strategy.
Well, maybe that would be no bad thing. Maybe that's somewhere I could agree with them.
So what needs to happen next, then?
Industrial trawling is really not the best way of managing our stocks for the future. We would be better off giving more quota to people who fish more sustainably. That means the inshore fleet, who are vitally important to local communities around the British coastline, and limited by the vagaries of the weather. So for two reasons, these are the people we should be giving our fishing opportunities to, but we don't. And so the whole quota system really needs looking at again.
Charles Clover. Well, we asked DEFRA for a response to the Blue Marine Foundation's allegations that quotas have been illegally set above scientific advice. And it told us catch limits have been set in line with obligations under the Fisheries Act 2020 and the Joint Fisheries Statement. It goes on to say, as litigation is ongoing, we cannot comment further as these are matters for the court's consideration. Well, it's not just the quantity of fish caught that has an impact on marine life, but also how it's done. Each year around the Scottish coast, more than 50 minke whales and basking sharks get accidentally tangled up in static fishing gear, like the ropes that link up creels. Now, creels are those boxy containers covered in netting that you may have noticed stacked up on the quayside in seaside towns and villages. They're used to catch crabs and lobsters. Creel fishermen on Scotland's west coast have been trialling what's called a sinking rope to try and reduce the numbers of whales, dolphins and basking sharks that get entangled. The trials were funded by the Scottish Government, and Kathleen Carragher has been speaking to Susanna Cauldron from Whale and Dolphin Conservation, who managed the project.
For minke whales, for example, that get entangled in the ground line, the rope that links the pots together on the seabed, minke whales usually aren't strong enough to swim with the gear, so they tend to drown on the seabed. Similar for basking sharks. Larger animals like humpback whales, they may be able to swim to the surface still entangled in the gear, and if someone finds them and is able to disentangle them, then that's good, but that's hazardous for the animals.
Susanna worked closely with Ballyphillip of the Scottish Creel Fishermen's Association, who's based on the Isle of Skye. He has first-hand experience of an entanglement.
I have had an entanglement of a basking shark, and the animal's dead when we hauled up our gear. And it was quite a distressing day for myself and the crew. I mean, after that happened, we just went home.
Normally, the ground line, which is the rope that links each creel pot together, is made out of floating polypropylene line. That's the cheapest, and that's what people have used for years and years and years. And what happens is the line floats in loops between each pot when it's on the seabed, and these loops can be 3 or 4 metres high. So a whale or a basking shark swimming along quite close to the seabed can get entangled in those loops of rope. What we were looking at was whether if you use rope that sinks rather than floats and lies on the seabed, then those loops aren't there.
And it was a pretty successful project.
It was extremely successful. So we have 15 fishermen that we worked with, and they re-roped over 60 sets of gear, and they fished with them for a year and a half. And really, nobody had any substantive problems. And it's available to buy sinking rope. It's just not widely used in fisheries because it's more expensive.
It's the same as a normal polypropylene kind of rope that we would use in the creel sector, but with the added strand of lead or zinc beads manufactured through one of the threads of the rope. You're talking about re-roping thousands of miles of creels. You're talking about taking lots of individual marginal businesses and asking them to come up with a big expense.
What we're looking at doing next is looking at options for how sinking rope might be implemented more widely. Could it be an incentive scheme? Could it be subsidies? Could it be a gear exchange programme? Those sort of things have happened in other areas. The creel fishery is a really big part of rural coastal communities, and we need to support them to be more environmentally sustainable than they want to be.
That report from Kathleen Carragher. Now, back to the 225th Westmorland County Show, where in a moment we'll be talking politics. But before that, you can't go to a show without visiting the food hall. Well, I can't.
It's fig and honey, mango and ginger. These are all fresh cheeses, not matured, so they're very light. All made with Jersey cow's milk.
That is a lovely big slab of white cheese with little dots of black pepper in it you've got there.
Goat cheese.
I've just come around the corner and there's a stall in front of me with loads of sausages, steak.
We farm up in North Cumbria, just below the Scottish border. Rare and traditional breeds, all off our own farm, which we then butch all ourselves.
How valuable is it for you as farmers and butchers, I suppose, to come out to an event like this and show people what you do? You know, put a face to the people who are buying your produce.
Yeah, it's really good because we can show people our passion, the quality and the love that goes into the food that we produce.
The food hall here is celebrating its 25th anniversary, and I am with a Cumbrian farmer and butcher who set it up 25 years ago. It's Peter Gott. He's with me now in his brown felt bowler hat and moleskin jacket. Hello, Peter.
How do you do?
Very well, thank you. 25 years. Why did you think this show needed a food hall 25 years ago?
Well, I was very fortunate to be sort of going around shows selling cheese and bacon. And I just felt that we had a lot of good food in Cumbria. So I said to the then Roger Reed, who was the CEO, why can't we have a food hall? And his reaction was, well, there's a tent, get on with it. So we put a tent up. It took us 2 days to dismantle it because it rained that hard. There was that much mud. Even with a long wheelbase Land Rover, it was a quagmire. But, you know, the small beginnings. I think we then realised that diversification even back then was important, you know, and we actually included people who were selling vacuum bags and packaging and labelling machines so that they could see that there was an opportunity to accept 25 quid for a herd of sheep at auction or actually further process it through local abattoirs and make £75 of it. And, you know, when you see a farmer looking and thinking, bye, £75, I'll have a go at that. It's more about just showing that initiative.
It's fantastic, though, looking around this food hall today because it's heaving, isn't it? There's a lot of people in here and they seem to be buying as well.
It's fantastic.
Congratulations, Peter Gott, and I'll let you get back to all these people who are trying to buy your sausages at the moment and gammon and goodness knows what else as well.
Thank you, God bless.
Now, small livestock farms, like many of the farmers who are competing at the show and indeed selling their produce here too, are most at threat from cuts to the agriculture budget, yet are in areas of the country we most need to invest in for nature, climate and public access. That's according to the environmental think tank, the Green Alliance. Farming and conservation groups have reacted with anger this week to the news of a £358 million underspend over the last 3 years in the government's budget for nature-friendly farm payments in England. These replace the old EU payments and reward farmers for environmental benefits like habitat restoration or carbon capture. There's concern that the underspend, £130 million last year from the annual £2.5 billion pot, become the norm in the expected Treasury cuts coming this autumn. The Green Alliance's Lydia Collis told me that upland livestock farms would be most affected.
The Sustainable Farming Incentive Scheme has been most attractive to arable farms. And when we look at what areas of the country haven't yet gone into new schemes in a big way, we see gaps in investment, particularly in national parks, in areas like the Peak District, the Lake District, Dartmoor, where these are farms that struggle to make an income just producing food. They tend to be grazing farms, and this is where there's huge potential to support these farmers with public money and pay for nature and better flood mitigation and water quality. So there's such huge potential in these areas to support farmers to do those things. But they generally haven't gone in at such a large scale into the new ELM schemes yet. And that's why we really can't see the budget cut at this point, because that will mean the early movers win and these farms that haven't managed to make it into the schemes in such a big way will lose out.
I mean, the Treasury is looking for further cuts right across the board at the moment to make up for this £22 billion shortfall. There may well be further cuts to the DEFRA budget. How damaging will that be in the future, would you say?
I think we need to see investment in farmers in the next 5 years in order to really set them up to hit the targets that we've set in terms of net zero, in terms of ending nature's decline in the UK. And so this is really crucial time to set in motion the changes that we'll really see, we'll see the big benefits of in the next couple of decades. So I think it could have a big impact on our ability to deliver those commitments that the government has signed up to and to support farmers in the way that they need.
That's Lydia Collis from Green Alliance. Government and its decisions are always near the top of the agenda for the next generation of young farmers. Will Longmire is a 26-year-old dairy farmer, and last year he was chair of Cumbria Young Farmers. Will, there's been some speculation in recent days that the underspend in the DEFRA budget might be baked into future budgets. With your young farmer's hat on, what do you make of that?
It is slightly worrying times for especially us as a younger generation trying to get into farming. The money was there to be spent, and it's disappointing that we couldn't really get it all spent. Going forward, such as the schemes like the SFI, whether or not they are too difficult for possibly the older sort of generation who aren't used to having to apply for, you know, the grants and schemes that are there for us, whether or not it can be more streamlined, that maybe it's a government-funded thing that people came out and actually sorted it for groups of people, and we didn't just do individual farms, we did areas, you know, we did valleys and helped to get the money out there to where it's really needed.
I've just been hearing from Green Alliance, and they have calculated that it's livestock farmers, particularly upland farmers, who will be who'll fare worst if future budget cuts take place. Can you describe what you think the impact may be?
Oh, well, it's very challenging farming in some of them in them areas, and the landscapes are very unforgiving. And to keep the food prices where it needs to be, that support is really needed. Unfortunately, once that money is gone, it is going to be so difficult for trying to get them to, you know, hand that back out. It really is a small amount of money in the grand schemes of the whole population, and the knock-on effect that it will have for everyone.
That's young farmer Will Longmire speaking to me at the Westmorland County Show. Well, Alistair Carmichael, the new EFRA committee chair, who we met earlier in the programme, asked the government about the farming budget underspend in Parliament this week.
If that money disappears back into Treasury, never to be seen again on farms, that money, that blame will attach to this current government. In opposition, they said that money that was underspent should be rolled over into future years. Is that still their position in government, and how are they going to do it?
The Minister for Nature, Mary Cray, gave this response.
What I would say is that there has been about a £350 million underspend in the farm budget under the last government. So the last government failed on their manifesto pledge to spend £2.4 billion a year on farmers. We are looking at everything as part of the spending review, and decisions will be announced in due course.
Well, we will no doubt have far more to bring you on this story over the coming weeks. But for now, that's all from us. I'm Kaz Graham. The producer is Heather Simons. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Thanks, Kaz. Now let's get a weekend weather check with Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Chris. Well, the weather's going to be warming up gradually through the weekend and into next week too, but it's not looking completely dry out there. We've got a weather front that's going to bring some rain and some wind across the northern half of the UK, particularly Scotland and Northern Ireland today. It'll shift a little bit further south into tomorrow. So mixed fortunes this weekend, depending on where you are. Across all of southern England into the Midlands and eastern England, we've got clear skies from the word go. Beautiful start to the day, but certainly crisp and chilly. Temperatures down in low single figures for some of us. And a bit of mistiness first thing, but that should quickly clear away. And then long spells of sunshine here, light winds, and it'll feel pleasantly warm in that sunshine, around 18 to 20 degrees. Into Wales, northern England and eastern Scotland, we've got a bit more cloud around here, and there's some patchy light rain this morning for eastern Scotland, northern England as well. That should ease away for a time, so brightening up a bit. Sunny spells across the region, but there will be some rain into the east of Scotland later in the afternoon. The breeze will be picking up as well, but a good deal of dry weather. And highs around about 17 to 19. For the southwest of Scotland, northern Scotland and Northern Ireland, cloudy start to the day. Patchy drizzle first thing, that should ease for a time. But later into the afternoon, that's when we see more persistent rain working its way gradually in from the west. It's also going to be particularly windy with gusts 40, perhaps even 50 miles an hour, especially breezy for the Western Isles. 16 to 18, but feeling cooler in that breeze. Now, heading through tonight, the rain will clear from Scotland and Northern Ireland, and we'll see patchy rain sitting across Northern England and North Wales. Clear spells elsewhere, the lowest temperatures again for Southern England, down to about 6 to 8 degrees here. Into tomorrow then, still a bit of patchy light rain for Northern England and North Wales too. A few showers tomorrow for Scotland, but not as windy as it will be today. Dry elsewhere though, and top temperatures tomorrow 16 to 20 degrees, and then high pressure builds into next week. So for all of us then, things are turning a little bit warmer and much drier and brighter into next week.
Sarah Keith Lucas. Later this morning, the historian siblings David and Yinka Onoshoga are guests on Saturday Live. That's beginning at 9 o'clock. Tonight, Radio 4 follows a famous artistic adventure.
David Bowie.
Berlin was probably the most rewarding for me as an artist in my life.
How his move to the city in the 1970s both saved and rejuvenated him.
He was in the mood to do something fresh, something new.
It was literally like being reborn.
I'm Francis Whateley, and I knew David for almost 20 years. For Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I'll be revealing what really happened during this mythologised period of his life.
This was in some ways a proposal.
Yes, I didn't know quite how to respond.
Bowie in Berlin, tonight at 8.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 14th of September. This is Today with Simon Jack and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. There has been no decision yet on allowing Ukraine to use Western-supplied long-range missiles on targets inside Russia, but the Prime Minister has welcomed productive discussions in Washington after meeting the US President. We'll speak to the former Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, at 10 past 8. Government analysis of its planned cut to winter fuel payments in England and Wales suggests more than 750,000 pensioners are not expected to claim the benefit, even though they're entitled to it. And 35,000 pupils at one of England's largest school academy trusts will be banned from using their smartphones during the school day. We'll discuss with a government advisor.
Also on today's programme, the NASA astronauts, stranded for months, have told how they're looking forward to voting in the US election from space.
I sent down my request for a ballot today. It's a very important role that we all play as citizens, is to be included in those elections, and NASA makes it very easy for us to do that. So we're excited about that opportunity.
And? Oh, we can be heroes just for one day. That new Radio 4 documentary explores how a move to the German city of Berlin allowed Bowie to reinvent himself.
Good morning from Mike Williams. With the sport, England's cricketers level the T20 series with a 3-wicket victory over Australia in Cardiff, whilst in the tennis, Great Britain lose to Argentina in the Davis Cup in Manchester.
That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
Sir Keir Starmer says he held wide-ranging and productive talks with President Biden about Ukraine, but wouldn't say whether he'd persuaded the US to allow Kiev to fire Western missiles into Russia. The Prime Minister said the talks at the White House concentrated on strategy rather than a particular step or tactic. Joe Biden said it was clear that Putin would not prevail. But Ukraine's President Zelensky urged the West not to put off a decision about long-range weapons, saying Russian missiles and drones continue to terrorise Ukraine's skies. Our political editor Chris Mason travelled with the Prime Minister to the White House.
Mr. Prime Minister, welcome.
This was a meeting at which Ukraine dominated. The Prime Minister and his team had spent the hours before in a secure room at the UK Embassy in conversation with British teams in Ukraine and Russia. President Zelensky still desperate for ongoing help, his allies weighing up how best to provide it and at what cost. The UK has been forward-facing, as it was put to me, in making the case to others to agree to Kyiv's request to be allowed to fire Western missiles into Russia. President Biden is sceptical, fearful it would drag America and Europe into direct conflict with Moscow. After their meeting, the Prime Minister wouldn't be drawn on whether he'd persuaded the President to change his mind.
Well, there's only one reason we're having these discussions, and that is because Putin has illegally invaded Ukraine. The quickest way to resolve this, obviously, lies through what Putin actually does, because it's for him to end this.
There was little expectation this meeting would resolve the issue, not least because further conversations with others at the United Nations are expected shortly. defeating Russia while not provoking Moscow, the essence of the West challenge since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2.5 years ago.
New analysis from the Department for Work and Pensions suggests people over 80 will lose out the most under the government's plans to cut winter fuel support for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. 7 out of 10 pensioners with a disability would also lose the payment. The Conservatives said the assessment was shocking. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has been studying the document.
The government has been criticised by opposition parties for not producing a full assessment of the impact of the winter fuel payment cuts on the health and well-being of older people. But the Department for Work and Pensions has released a more limited equalities analysis, which considers the likely impact on different groups of pensioners. It suggests that around 100,000 more people could be persuaded to claim pension credit and therefore retain the winter fuel payment. But more than 750,000 pensioners who are eligible are still not expected to submit a claim and would therefore lose the payment. The analysis also suggests that the over 80s would lose the most financially. A Treasury spokesman said more than 1 million pensioners would still receive the payment this winter, and the focus was now on ensuring that those who should be claiming it would receive it.
One of England's largest school academy trusts is set to become the first of its size to ban students from using mobile phones at school. Ormiston Academies Trust says it's begun phasing out access to smartphones at its 44 state schools across the country after the Department for Education issued updated advice giving schools in England greater options to ban or restrict the devices. Our correspondent Vincent McAvinney has more.
Ormiston Academies Trust, which educates around 35,000 pupils across the country, says it has begun removing access to smartphones across its 12 primary and 32 state secondary schools. Tom Rees, the Academy's chief executive, says smartphones have disrupted students' learning and their well-being. In particular, he says social media is causing huge issues with mental health. Technology Secretary Peter Kyle has told the BBC he's looking very closely at the impact of an Australian ban on social media for all under-16s.
The former chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch and his British partner are facing more allegations that they sexually exploited men at events they hosted around the world. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith are already defending a civil lawsuit alleging they ran a sex trafficking operation. Last year, the BBC revealed a middleman had been tasked with finding men for these events. Here's our investigations correspondent, Rhianna Croxford.
The BBC has now spoken to 20 men who say they attended or helped organise sex events for Mike Jeffries. These took place from 2009 until 2015, while he was chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch. The new allegations come from men who say they felt exploited and abused. The FBI has been investigating since the BBC first revealed allegations against Mr. Jeffries last year. He is already facing a civil lawsuit over allegations of sex trafficking. A lawyer for Mr. Jeffries, who retired in 2014, has previously said he denied allegations of wrongdoing. Mr. Smith has never responded to requests for comment.
The Westminster government has said it won't fund the redevelopment of a stadium in Belfast in time for the 2028 European Football Championships. Without Casement Park, it's likely that Northern Ireland will be the only UK nation not to host matches during the tournament. The Liberal Democrats conference is getting underway in Brighton this morning, where the party will come together for the first time since winning 72 seats in Parliament. Health and social care is on the agenda, as our political correspondent Hannah Miller reports.
The Liberal Democrats say that being the third party in Parliament is a big responsibility and brings with it a far greater ability to affect change. But their record-breaking results in the general election were achieved by pitching themselves in opposition to the Conservatives, raising the question of what the party does now that Labour is in government. As their conference gets underway, the Lib Dems say they want to be a constructive opposition, pointing to their criticism of the government's decision to means test the winter fuel payment as a recent example. With health and social care due to be the focus of debate this afternoon, they will claim to be the party of the NHS and care in every part of Britain.
Two astronauts stuck on the International Space Station have insisted they don't feel let down by Boeing, despite being stranded there because of problems with the company's spacecraft. Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore said they missed friends and family, but were not worried about their situation. Ms. Williams said she'd be voting in US presidential election in November.
Looking forward to being able to vote from space, which is pretty cool. You asked what we miss, right? Of course, you know, the things that we always miss, our families. I miss my two dogs. I miss my friends. There are so many people on Earth that are sending us messages, and it makes you feel just right at home with everybody when we're able to have those conversations with our friends and family.
Strictly Come Dancing returns tonight with 15 new celebrities taking to the dance floor as the contest enters its 20th year. The show's faced a challenging time this year, with a number of former contestants making allegations about the way they were treated when they took part. The BBC says it has introduced new welfare measures, as the entertainment journalist Natalie Jameson explains.
There are welfare producers on hand, there are psychologists on hand, so that if somebody is feeling the strain too much or is not kind of comfortable with something, there are many very well signposted outlets that they can go and seek help and advice. So all the kind of buzz so far seems to be that this year's cohort, and it's the same every year, are very excited about being on the show and feel very supported in that environment.
Natalie Jameson on tonight, Strictly.
Thank you, Chris. 9 minutes past seven. Let's take a first look at what's making news in the papers, in the weekend papers, not just Strictly, of course. There is a lot about those talks in Ukraine. More on that in just a second. But two headlines on that. The Daily Mail: Zelensky, stop delays and let us fire missiles into Russia. Zelensky, Putin burns our city as West delays, is the Times front page. Comments from the Ukrainian president before the talks emerged. Before Keir Starmer emerged from the talks he'd had with Joe Biden, which were apparently inconclusive, unless we discover that they have agreed, but they haven't announced what that agreement is yet. Inside the Mail, it lists the reasons that Joe Biden has traditionally been hesitant about escalation. The fear of Putin's possible reprisals, ranging from sabotage missions on Western bases, diplomatic measures such as the expulsion yesterday of British diplomats, attacks on UK-US undersea cable networks, extending assistance to Houthi rebels in Yemen, and so on and so forth.
The Guardian leads with a story you heard there in the headlines about a school academy chain which is banning mobile phones. That's a problem that it's an issue we've wrestled with on this programme many times. The Ormiston Academies Trust, which runs 44 schools, including 32 secondary schools, has begun phasing out access to phones at all its schools. And they've got a quote here from their headmaster there, or the boss of that trust, who says it doesn't even matter whether you're using it. He said it's not just about having your phone out and using it, it's the mere presence of the phone. There's evidence that tells us that even if your phone's in the same room, it could be in your bag or pocket, your brain is leaking attention, still thinking about it and being drawn to it, wondering if there's been a notification on it and what it might be. And we'll be talking to an advisor, a behavioural psychology advisor to the government about that very issue later in the programme.
Headline in the Telegraph: secrets of how five Tory PMs were filled. This is because it's got the rights to publish. From the memoirs of Graham Brady, Lord Brady is his now, Sir Graham we always used to talk of, the man, it was said, who had the letters in his safe. The letters that were the crucial letters for triggering a plot against a sitting Conservative Prime Minister. Well, they're serialised in the Telegraph magazine today. His book's called Kingmaker, and it just is a reminder of the extent to which Conservatives were moving against each other. Now, crucially, he reveals that when people claim that Rishi Sunak had to have an election because he would have been toppled, that is not true. He had only 10 letters of no confidence in his safe, nothing like enough to force Rishi Sunak to quit as Tory leader. He does, though, recall how Jeremy Hunt, Sajid Javid and Michael Gove all tried to move against Theresa May, who he described as wooden at the height of the Brexit saga. Also that Mr Hunt, when he was appointed as Chancellor by Liz Truss, told Lord Brady that she would have to quit pretty much immediately from his job. He gossips about Tories he's worked with as well, saying that David Cameron and George Osborne had contempt for people who didn't share their social backgrounds, and describes how Boris Johnson referred to colleagues in a phrase not repeatable on a Saturday morning.
It's 13 minutes past seven. Let's go back to the progress of the Prime Minister, because he's in the air, we think, at the moment, about to touch down after his visit to the US, where he and the US President Joe Biden wrestled with this question as to whether they should allow US and UK long-range missiles to be fired deep into Russia. Also in the air, of course, that warning from Vladimir Putin that doing so would put NATO at war with Russia. So what emerged from these high-stakes talks? I've been talking to Sarah Smith, our North America editor, and started by asking her, what do we know about what was said?
There was a conversation about Ukraine, about the supply of weapons and how they can be used, but that wasn't all of it. They talked about the Middle East as well. It was a wide-ranging discussion about a number of conflicts, and both sides are eager to stress that this was not a meeting simply about whether or not Ukraine can use Western-supplied weapons to strike into Russia. And there was no decision about that announced. And frankly, I don't think there ever will be. It could be that we will just see or not on the ground that Ukraine is able to use long-range weapons supplied by the UK to fire into Russia, those Storm Shadow missiles. Probably not US-supplied ones, that would be a whole separate decision. But I wouldn't hold your breath for a press release saying that that has been decided.
So it would be strategically disadvantageous to sort of say, we're about to do it, so we'll just learn in the event.
Exactly. If indeed that is what was decided, because neither the White House nor Downing Street are eager to say that any decision had been reached at all, and stress that wasn't the focus of the meeting. And what was being discussed, of course, was the possibility of these UK-provided weapons being used by Ukraine to strike at targets inside Russia. It was a whole different conversation as to whether or not any of the American-supplied weapons would be allowed to do that, the Army Tactical Missile Systems, known as ATACMS. That would be of a different order if the White House, if President Biden said to Ukraine they could use those, because all along, what the White House has been so eager to avoid is any sense that Russia and America had come into direct conflict, World War III, as President Biden often describes it. They may come to the point where they decide that, but that will be a much bigger step. That said, of course, President Biden has got 4 months left in office now, and I think he knows very well what decisions he makes in the coming weeks. Maybe the last big opportunity he has to alter the course of the conflict in Ukraine. And, you know, we know that if Donald Trump is re-elected, he will take a very different approach to Ukraine. It would be very, very unlikely that he would supply any American aid there. And he said he wants to end the conflict very quickly, although he has never told us exactly how he wants to do that. So this is fairly critical time for President Biden to make some important decisions about the conduct of that conflict.
Sarah, thank you.
Time now is coming up to 16 minutes past seven.
Let's pick up on that again, because we got Kurt Volker, the former United States Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations, on the line. And Mr. Volker, how close do you think we are to getting a decision on this? And as Sarah Smith was suggesting there, is it the kind of thing you would announce or the kind of thing you would just do?
Yeah, actually, I have to say what she said is exactly what I had been thinking, is that they don't want to make a big announcement out of this because it then gives the U.S. and U.K. a sense of more ownership of attacks inside Russia. And they're desperately trying to avoid the appearance of this being a Western war against Russia, U.S. war against Russia. So I think they are trying to avoid making that kind of definitive announcement. That being said, I do think there continues to be an irrational skepticism in Washington about the firing of missiles at a longer range to hit targets inside Russia. It's clearly something that Russia is doing to Ukraine every day. Mm-hmm. It would clearly make a difference in air defense for Ukraine by forcing Russia to push some of its forces back and protect them more, take less risks. And so it seems that it is overdue for a decision like this. It just may be that it starts to happen in an incremental way without any kind of announcement.
It's a hell of a thing to do for a president in the last few weeks in office when you've got a change of administration on the horizon one way or another. It's quite a high stakes thing to do in the last couple of weeks in office.
It is and it's not. Every time we have set out some kind of red line that is in our mind, so we mustn't provide aircraft, or we mustn't provide armor, we mustn't provide Stinger missiles, we mustn't provide HIMARS, and then we do it. It doesn't affect Russia one way or the other. Russia is already engaged in a massive war against Ukraine. They're throwing everything at it they can. They're not winning, but they're not losing. And I think we overplay the sense of, oh, this is now some new red line that would be so provocative to Russia that it would create some kind of new escalation. It's simply overthought.
So this is not a new boundary. Because we had the Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski on this programme this week saying not to attach too much importance to Vladimir Putin's threat that this would be a declaration of war between Russia and NATO. You would agree with that?
I totally agree. The reason Putin says those things is to achieve the result of deterring us from doing things. Not that it actually has any bearing on what he's really going to do or what he really thinks.
Okay. Kurt Volker, the former United States Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, thank you.
It's now 7:18. Germany's preparing to impose new migration controls at the border with its nine neighbours from Monday. It's part of Berlin's response to rising public concern about migration and a surge in support for the far right after deadly knife attacks in which the suspects were asylum seekers. Let's talk to our correspondent in Germany, Damian McGuinness. Morning to you, Damian. When we interviewed a leading Social Democrat the other day, he was trying desperately to play down the significance. What will actually change on Monday?
Yeah, it's interesting because on the ground, I think you could argue not much will change because Germany already has spot checks, effectively, on most of its southern and eastern borders. And the border to Austria, there's already been these sorts of checks since 2015 when large numbers of people came from the Middle East. But politically, this is a huge shift to now have this on all of Germany's borders. So I think if people are travelling to Germany, they might not notice that much. There will be individual cars flagged down. There'll be officials maybe walking through trains asking for documents from certain individuals. So what they're trying to do is keep free movement going for trade, commuters, towns that are cross-border towns between Germany and its neighbours, while at the same time increasing spot checks. But politically, this is huge, because what Germany is saying, what this government is saying, is that they want to clamp down quite heavily on irregular migration. And they're doing that by some quite dramatic measures that they want to enforce from Monday. So I think even though it's not going to affect most people crossing back and forwards across the border, I think this is a huge shift in certainly the rhetoric, the tone, and the political signalling when it comes to how Germany deals with irregular migration.
And it could involve, presumably, them sending back people who are claiming asylum who they think would not get it in Germany. How have countries surrounding Germany, how's the country's neighbours reacted to that?
Very mixed. Austria said, well, we don't want to deal with your problem, effectively. Viktor Orban of Hungary said, welcome to the club. Other countries have voiced concerns over whether this would impact trade and cross-border commuting, but are open to the idea of more border controls. But as I say, we have seen this over the past few years. Soccer, Euros, football championship, there have also been controls. So it's something people are used to. But I think within Germany, the reactions have been really, really tough, because from the right, they say this is just political signalling. From the left, people are saying, well, this undermines Germany's legal and moral commitments to refugees. It's a very different Germany, Nick, to that of Angela Merkel 10 years ago when she welcomed in 1.5 million refugees and migrants. It's very dramatic. And I think what we're seeing is a government that's pushing through some quite controversial measures with some big legal questions about what do you do if someone is rejected at the border, but where do you put them? Are they going to be effectively put in prison? And, you know, there's all sorts of legal implications around there which haven't really been solved by the government.
Damian McGuinness, our correspondent in Germany, thank you.
The Archbishop of Canterbury says a major review of the UK's defence should prepare to wage peace. The Most Reverend Justin Welby was speaking yesterday in Parliament in a debate in the Lords on the catastrophic war in Sudan. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
The United Nations says the conflict in Sudan has created the world's worst hunger crisis, and there are accusations of war crimes, sexual violence and genocide. Peers were debating the fighting that's been going on in Sudan for nearly 18 months after a power struggle broke out between two generals, one who leads the army and one who controls a powerful paramilitary group. The Foreign Office Minister, Lord Collins, described the scale of the crisis as staggering.
Sudan is facing a man-made famine and one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. More than 10 million people have been forced to leave their homes. Recent widespread flooding has pushed the country to the brink.
Famine was declared in Sudan at the end of August, and it's estimated 100 people are dying every day from starvation. Lord Collins said the UK had almost doubled its support for the country to around £97 million. The Liberal Democrat, Lady Sutty, said this sometimes felt like the forgotten war. She told Piers she'd spent a year working in the country and her last visit had been in 2023, a week before the conflict started.
It is, I believe, the most cynical of wars. It's not a war about ideals or ideology, but it's about personal wealth, power, influence and access to natural resources.
A Conservative former Foreign Office Minister, Lord Ahmed, asked about what he called the pathways to peace and initiatives through organisations such as the African Union and countries including Egypt, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
In all these areas, in all this diplomacy, at times it needs to be inclusive, absolutely. It also needs to be constructive. But I also add, through experience, at times it needs to be discreet, because that unlocks the potential solution.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, referred to the UK government's ambition to see a return to civilian rule.
But as we have seen elsewhere, peace with an authoritarian government is better than no peace at all. And I hope that is not so much of a red line that we will not work to establish the ceasefire and the stability which will enable civilians to take over.
But there was another question: how to prevent such disasters around the world in future. How, he asked, could we wage peace? And he pointed to the government's strategic defence review, arguing it needed to look not just at preparing for conflict.
A peace-building option, well-developed and acting in areas of fragility, would extend our influence, protect our interest, and, as has been said several times, guard against fresh waves of migration.
A former chief of the defence staff and independent peer, Lord Stirrup, said there were hard-headed reasons why people in the UK should be worried about the situation in Sudan. The rise of groups like Islamic State, the threat to the security of commercial traffic through the Red Sea, and the increasing number of migrants fleeing the country.
A fifth of the population has been made homeless, and they face the prospect of a deadly famine that could kill millions. At the moment, staying put looks like a death sentence, and the surrounding countries are probably not that appealing to them either. Europe would seem a much better bet.
And Lord Stirrup said that meant more business for people smugglers, an increasing traffic in human misery, and the continued rise of right-wing extremism in Europe.
Alicia McCarthy reporting there. It's now 26 minutes past seven. Imagine you think you're off on a trip for a few days. You end up having to stay for 8 months. That is the plight of the NASA astronauts who've been stuck on the International Space Station since June after their Boeing Starliner spacecraft was deemed unfit to take them back down to Earth. They won't get the chance to return now until February. The two Americans gave a news conference yesterday about how they're coping. Astronaut Butch Wilmore talked about how he's ready to vote from space.
I sent down my request for a ballot today, as a matter of fact, and they should get it to us in a couple of weeks. And absolutely, yes, it's a very important role that we all play as citizens, is to be included in those elections, and NASA makes it very easy for us to do that. So we're excited about that opportunity.
Well, listening to that, Helen Sharman, first British astronaut to go into space, the first woman to visit the Mir space station back just a few years ago, Helen, in May 1991. Good morning. Welcome to the Today Programme.
Good morning. Yes, it feels like yesterday.
Even hearing him talk about voting is a reminder of how dramatically different their experience is to yours because of the internet.
Exactly. Their communications are pretty much 24/7 these days on ISS. They've got satellites that they can use. So not only do they have electronic communications like email, but they can, you know, literally phone home using satellites to do that. So, yes, they don't feel as disconnected as astronauts used to do. Yeah, that whole idea of being able to suddenly put in your application to vote, of course, and everything else that they need to do in terms of their communications, right down to the detail of on-the-job training with mission control, they can get training in the form of videos even. So stuff that they might have done face-to-face isn't so bad now doing it remotely.
And yet being away from home, from family, from friends, from loved ones for that amount of time is quite a strain, isn't it?
I think it's not so much the strain of being away for so long, although, of course, there are elements of that. It's the change that you have to go through. And Butch and Sonny both talked about the transition that they had to make between the short-term mission that they'd originally had planned for and now what's turning into something much longer. And, of course, they're not the only ones who've done it. I mean, recently there was a Soyuz spacecraft that had a leak, and so the astronauts up there weren't allowed to return on that until another one had been sent to the space station. So their mission was extended from 6 to 12 months. That was, you know, just a couple of years ago. My flight engineer, Sergei Krikulov, spent 10 months in space instead of 5 and came back down to a Soviet Union that was actually now all separated and became Russia.
Everything had changed.
Yeah. So, yeah, they've got models to work from, but there is a transition. And I think you pace yourself, don't you, for anything. And even if I think it is very enjoyable for them in space and they're feeling useful, it's still something that you have to get your head around, this longer term.
It's not just the communications that have changed, is it? I mean, my memories of your mission is that, you know, all food was in tinned, and I imagine not that glamorous or tasty, was it?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's all of those details of life that make it so much easier these days. It is a bit more of a luxury stay, I think, on board ISS than compared to the Mir space station was. So yes, from food, even sleeping arrangements. So there are 6 sleep stations on ISS. That does mean that, you know, right now there are 12 people up there. So 6 people don't have a little sleep station, but most of the time, most of them do have a place to put their own little personal possessions. So you're not constantly rolling up your sleeping bag every morning and putting it away. That's quite nice.
Last quick thought, if we could, Helen, when you watch them, do you think, I wish I was back there?
Oh, I'd love to be back, yes. I think nearly everybody wants to go back, apart from those that have spent many, many months, many times in space. I'd love to be back, even if I were up there for 8 months instead of 8 days.
Helen Sharman, thanks so much for sharing your memories with us. Thank you.
And talking about floating around in a tin can like Major Tom, we're going to be talking about David Bowie's period in Berlin when he came crashing back down to Earth after his time in California. But let's get some sport with Mike.
That's a good link, isn't it?
Brilliant.
That is a very good segue. Enjoyed that. Enjoyed that. Let's start with cricket, shall we? Victory in Cardiff last night for England. A 3-wicket win in the second T20 match with Australia saw England not only level the series heading into the decider on Sunday, but also give Phil Salt a first victory as standing captain.
I'm really enjoying it. You always enjoy it more when you win. Obviously, this is a great feeling for myself. But, you know, to keep the series alive and head to Old Trafford on Sunday with the series on the line, it's everything you dream of as a kid, really.
Yeah, impressive performance from England. Liam Livingston smashing a superb 87 from 47 balls. As Phil Salt was saying, the final T20 is tomorrow at Old Trafford. So a good day for England's cricketers, but a bad day for Europe's golfers at the Solheim Cup. This is the women's version of the Ryder Cup, of course, and the defending champions have given themselves an uphill task of defending their title. Reporting from Virginia, here's golf correspondent Ian Carter.
By her own admission, Suzanne Pettersson's team already faces a massive task to retain the trophy. For the first time this century, they lost both sessions in a day, with Nelly Korda, the driving force, leading from the front in morning and afternoon. Europe had little answer. Maya Stark and Emily Pedersen couldn't repeat their morning heroics. Charlie Hull, Lynn Grant, Georgia Hall and Leona Maguire were all well below their best. Every defeat was by a convincing margin. On this bleak opening day, only Anna Nordqvist and Madeline Sagstrom provided any afternoon cheer, and finding a way to emulate their standards will be a considerable challenge.
Day two of the Solheim Cup getting underway a little later on. You can follow coverage of that on the BBC Sport website and commentary on BBC Sounds from 5:30. Meanwhile, in Manchester, defeat two for Great Britain in tennis's Davis Cup. They were beaten in the latest round-robin match against Argentina yesterday. Dan Evans lost his singles match, as did the recent US Open semi-finalist Jack Draper.
Is it best for my body and my mind and my health to have a week off, considering the schedule? Probably. But, you know, obviously I'm someone who loves playing for my country and loves to be a part of the team. And so it was the right decision in my own mind, and it is still the right decision.
GB still have another tie against Canada tomorrow in Manchester. In Formula One, qualifying for the Azerbaijan Grand Prix takes place later today. You can follow that from 2 p.m. over on 5 Sports Extra. Also on BBC Sounds, Ferrari's Charles Leclerc was fastest in second practice yesterday. Whilst in rugby union, it's the first test at the newly named Allianz Stadium today as England's women play a friendly with their arch rivals and six times world champions, New Zealand. The stadium, formerly known as Twickenham, is the same venue that will host next year's Women's Rugby World Cup final. Our rugby reporter Sarah Orchard has more.
The Black Ferns might have been hugging King Charles earlier this week, but there won't be such a warm welcome for them from the Red Roses come 2:30 this afternoon. It's world number ones versus world champions, and the match is billed as a friendly, but there is nothing friendly about these two sides who continue to play out the greatest rivalry in women's rugby. England make five changes, including a return for stalwart Emily Scarrett to the 13 shirt, whilst the Black Ferns reintroduce star winger Aisha Letiainga, who plays for her country for the first time in nearly 2 years after an ACL injury.
Meanwhile, in Rugby League's Super League, Wigan remain in pole position to win the league leaders' shield after scoring seven tries in a 38-0 victory over Leeds Rhinos last night. Elsewhere, St Helens closed in on a playoff spot with a 40-4 victory over Castleford, whilst Hull KR beat Lee 24-0. In football, the Premier League returns today. Southampton against Manchester United is the early kickoff at 12:30. At 3, you can hear Liverpool against Nottingham Forest on 5 Live. That's followed by one of the oldest fixtures in English football, Aston Villa against Everton from 5:30. And a reminder that the St. Ledger Festival continues at Doncaster, which means the tips have returned to the Today programme. And good news, we had a winner yesterday. I'm delighted to report that. A 7-2 winner yesterday, Asterius, on the first day of the festival. Today's tips, let's see if we can do any better at this. Both at Doncaster, of course, at 3 o'clock, number 9, lead artist. And then at 3:40, number 7, in the big one, the St. Ledger U. Got to me.
They need to win as a tribute to Gary Richardson. We're all slightly bleary this morning. It was Gary's leaving party at Broadcasting House yesterday. Now, talking of BH, Paddy O'Connell's here to tell us what to expect tomorrow.
Hello. Tomorrow morning, we'll have Russia's military threats rated through history. We'll have a defence deep dive with warhorse Robert Fox. We test shoppers on fish. A survey suggests we islanders are all at sea over species and often mistake John Dory for a poet. Radio legend Ken Bruce celebrates the brains behind one of the most popular quizzes on the air. And we watch out for tonight's return of Strictly and the last night of the proms. BH is on BBC Sounds and on air here on Radio 4 tomorrow morning from 9.
Quick look at the weather. This morning will turn mostly dry for a time, with variable cloud in the north and sunshine in the south. In the afternoon, a band of rain will move across the northwest.
Time now is 7:55. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Nick Robinson. And Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer says that he's held a long and productive discussion with President Biden about Ukraine, but wouldn't be drawn as to whether he'd persuaded the US to allow Kiev to fire long-range Western missiles into Russian territory. Sir Keir, who's in Washington, said they'd discuss strategy. Joe Biden said it was clear that Putin would not prevail. But Ukraine's President Zelensky urged the West not to put off a decision about long-range weapons, saying Russian missiles and drones continued to terrorise Ukraine's skies. Analysis carried out for the government of its planned cut to winter fuel payments in England and Wales has revealed that more than 750,000 pensioners are not expected to claim the benefit, even though they're entitled to it. The equalities analysis produced for the Department for Work and Pensions also showed that people over 80 will lose the most financially. One of England's largest school academy trusts is set to become the first of its size to ban students from using mobile phones at school. Ormiston Academies Trust says it's phasing out access to smartphones for around 35,000 pupils at its 44 state schools. More men have come forward to the BBC accusing the former chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch and his British partner of sexual exploitation. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith are already defending a civil lawsuit alleging they ran a sex trafficking operation. The FBI is also investigating. Last year, the BBC revealed a middleman had been tasked with finding men for these events. A former lawyer of Mr. Jeffries has previously said he denied allegations of wrongdoing. Mr. Smith has never responded to requests for comment. The Liberal Democrats' conference is getting underway in Brighton this morning, where the party will come together for the first time since winning 72 seats in Parliament. Health and social care is due to be the focus this afternoon. Strictly Come Dancing returns for its 20th year tonight, with a fresh string of celebrities hitting the dance floor. The BBC has introduced new welfare measures following allegations by former contestants about their treatment on the show.
23 minutes to eight. I think I detected enthusiasm and excitement there from Chris about the return of Strictly. Let's go to 22 minutes to eight. This weekend, those running prisons in England and Wales may permit themselves a small sigh of relief. The mass early release of 1,700 prisoners a few days ago means that there is, at last, a little spare capacity in the system. That, though, will be in stark contrast to the victims of some of those released, who will have spent this week fearful of what might happen next. If, that is, they were forewarned about the release of their attackers, not all were. And there are more releases of more serious offenders to come next month. Let's talk to the victims' commissioner now. Helen Newlove, Baroness Newlove. Her husband Gary was murdered after he confronted a gang of drunken youths vandalising her car back in 2007. Baroness Newlove, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Your mind always on victims. Have you managed to make any assessment of what the impact on victims has been this week?
At the moment, no, but I want to reassure everybody that I have been there at the table, always focusing on the concerns of this early release for the victims to make sure that, you know, everybody has been contacted where possible. But it doesn't mean to say that where they're not possible, we don't keep on searching and make sure that victims' concerns are raised at the highest level.
And there are some people who are not, as it were, entitled on the rules to be contacted, weren't there?
Yes, under the victim contact scheme, if you are sentenced to 12 months or more, you can opt into the victim contact scheme, which then enables the probation to contact you. However, there is other victims who are not on that contact scheme. That's the bit that I am really concerned about, because obviously, you know, they've listened to a direction within the court trial and have got a date in their mind, and now to be concerned that actually their the offender is now going to release. So I am really, you know, on the button on this one.
Yeah. Particularly talking about women, aren't we? And particularly talking about victims of domestic abuse, where the perpetrator gets a shorter sentence, less than 12 months for an assault, and people might not know about that release.
Well, that is the problem. I mean, I know the government, you know, are really working hard to mitigate these risks by excluding domestic abusers, stalkers. But if, for example, somebody's been charged with assault and they're on that four-year cut-off point, you know, they could be past history where they are domestic abusers. And that's my concern about that, how we protect the victim from being released. How do we protect the victim who's gone through that? And that's always been paramount in my mind.
Do you want to see changes before the next releases, which are of people who have got much more serious offences by their name and are serving longer sentences?
Well, this is what we're in discussions about now. I've been there from day one, and, you know, there's no doubt, you know, I'm really, really frustrated that the previous government failed to act. I mean, this has not, you know, just happened overnight. So my primary concern is always that victims really are at the forefront on a level playing field. But yes, that we know we've got a second tranche, as they say, in October, and I am really I'm working alongside all of the ministers, probation, public protection, to ensure that we get all as many victims ahead of the first, you know, the second wave again.
It's interesting
because it has to be addressed, Nick. It really does.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you express your frustration with the previous government. You blame them for this, do you?
I don't blame's a word, but we have this didn't happen overnight, and no government should actually fail to look at how our prisons get the capacity. So yes, I'm frustrated that for victims to be placed in this position. That's why it's got to be a very temporary measure, and of course the probation service is one of the critical roles in managing the offenders in the community. So, of course, I'm really concerned about the resourcing for them to be able to do so. But I'm also want victims to be reassured as well that I'm also ensuring that, if they want restrictions and conditions themselves, they're able to ask that. And that's why we've got to look at it. And most importantly, if these offenders breach their licence conditions, they're immediately taken back and recalled into prison. There's no ifs and buts about that.
Ministers will have heard that, no doubt. Baroness Newlove, Victims Commissioner, thank you for joining us.
18 minutes to 8. Listen very carefully. I will say this only once. You may remember that line from the TV show Allo, Allo, which lampooned the period of Nazi occupation of France in the early 1940s. But the real picture of what life was like at that time has emerged through a photo album found in a flea market in the south of France, with hundreds of pictures of Paris as a captive city. And these were taken at a time when outdoor photography was strictly banned by the occupiers. The photos are being published by French newspaper Le Monde. And earlier I spoke to the journalist Philippe Broussard, who helped unearth them. I started to ask him just how significant this discovery was.
It's incredible. In fact, all the historians I've been speaking to say it's incredible because it was strictly forbidden at that time to take photos, except, of course, the collaboration people and the professional journalists who were working with the Germans. Those photos are different. They are from an amateur, not a professional, and they were taken by someone who was always in the shadows of the Germans. He was in the streets of Paris like a ghost, a spy, taking photos of German officers, for example, with French girls. And what is astonishing is the fact that every photo has a number, a date, and some comments. Comments in a very French style, I would say, like slang words, saying, oh, look, the German is going to the hostel with two girls, things like that. It's incredible.
Mm. Does it tell us anything about this time that we didn't already know? What do we learn from the atmosphere of this period?
We see the city as it was really. I mean, they are not propaganda photos. So it means the city was grey, deserted by some of the population, and it was a captive and mute city. That was the real Paris.
And tell us more about how you unearthed this album and the whole journey of this investigation.
It began in 2020 when a friend of mine, a girl, called me saying, oh, I found on a flea market in the south of France a strange photo album, 377 photos taken between 1940 and 1942, that's to say in the first 2 years of occupation. We did not know where that album came from. We did not know who was the photographer. And then the investigation began, and it lasted 4 years.
And what do we know about the person who took them?
At the end, last spring, I discovered at last the identity of that person. It was a man who was working in a French famous department store, which was Le Printemps, the spring in English, which is a kind of French Harrods. And he was a normal employee, an ordinary man, but his photo was his passion. And so when the German arrived in Paris and took power, he began to take photos, hundreds and hundreds of photos.
Mm. And the penalty for actually taking photographs were quite severe. You would be deported, imprisoned.
It was a massive risk. I mean, at least prison and deportation. And that is what happened. I mean, it was a letter of denunciation, an anonymous letter was sent to the French police saying, oh, you should have a look at that guy who was working in the Printemps. He's taking photos. And so he was arrested by the French police. deported to Mauthausen and Buchenwald, and he died there, just after the arrival of the American.
You talk about his wife. Tell us a little bit more about what his wife knew of him.
I'm sure that she perfectly knew what he was doing. She was not arrested, but when he was deported, she tried to get news from him. I mean, just after the war, when the camps were freed, he went out from Buchenwald. He tried to walk away, but he was so exhausted that he died in 45. But the body has never been recovered. And I have documents that I am publishing today in my newspaper showing how Mart, his wife, tried to have news and to know where he was. And she struggled for years and years, but the body has never been recovered.
But the photographs remain an incredible document. And where can we see these? Is there an exhibition, or do we read Le Monde? Or where can we see some of these?
For the moment, I'm sorry, you have to read Le Monde. Of course, we cannot publish all the photos. There are more than 700. But we will organize, we and museums will organize in the next few months, a huge exhibition. You know, when I began to investigate on that case, it was a kind of a challenge for me, a professional and a personal one. I mean, the challenge was to know the name of that man who had the courage of doing such a thing. So there will be exhibitions. There will be, I think, a book with all the photos. He deserves it. And his name was Raoul Minot, a typically French name.
A wonderful story. Philippe Broussard, journalist who led the investigation at Le Monde into this extraordinary photograph album. Thank you very much.
It is coming up to 12 minutes to 8 now, and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning in the studio is the Reverend Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell Welling Garden City. Morning to you, Rob.
Good morning, Nick. Morning, Simon. Well, today is likely to be the busiest of the 10 Heritage Open Days held every September in England. It's a chance for thousands of people to explore buildings which are usually closed to the public, maybe wander up bell towers, hang out in little-known libraries, see bits of history that are usually cordoned off. And these special days, when people see well-preserved glimmers of how we used to live, are an opportunity to assess and to learn from the past. I suppose we can define heritage as those traditions, beliefs and values which have fashioned cultural change over many centuries. And the academic discipline of biblical studies obviously has a lot to say about heritage. I studied the subject in its heyday at Sheffield University, and I remember vividly the lecturers emphasising how what we were learning informed our understanding of faith and belief. Those ancient languages, visits to amazing archaeological sites, including Qumran, site of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and relating the heritage of sacred godly text to our own culture. It's really fascinating area. And those original documents cover many centuries. They portray a creator God, a people far from perfect, and a nagging refrain that in the future, as Julian of Norwich will later claim, all will be well. I think of this when I recite the biblical Psalms. A Christian declares that the wisdom proclaimed is as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be. Sacred heritage then speaks of the past in the present whilst looking to the future. But perhaps it demands honesty in the process. Maybe we're getting more honest about the way we view our heritage in the United Kingdom. A recent British social attitude survey showed a significant fall in the level of the population's pride in our country's history. And this is something welcomed by the historian Professor Alan Lester, who explained how history is complicated. We've done admirable things and deplorable things in the past. And he suggests that assessing our heritage involves breaking down history into the kind of things that we see as sources of pride, and those things which we need to move on and beyond from. Such a candid approach to recognising how we've arrived at where we are may not be new, but it is wise. And it puts in mind, in my head, St. Paul in his important letter to the people of first century Rome, that the past is there to provide wisdom and discernment, encouraging hope and confidence for the future. So as this weekend's Heritage Open Days get underway, and I hope they go well wherever they're going to take place, we have another opportunity to learn, to share with others, and to celebrate community. To think about those traditions we've hung on to, and the ones best perhaps left in the past, and to take lessons that we'll learn into the future.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Rob Marshall. Time now, 9 minutes to 8.
How to fix the NHS is a question that has dominated the headlines this week after the release of the Darzi report that painted a bleak picture of the present and future capability of the health system. One of the key findings or recommendations was that the NHS desperately needs to go digital. A technological revolution can and must be part of the solution. So, how close are we? What is the situation at the moment? We can talk to Dr. Rupert Pearce, who's a professor of intensive care at Queen Mary University of London. He also practices medicine at a London teaching hospital. And Professor Andrew Morris, Director of Health Data Research UK and Vice Principal of Data Science at the University of Edinburgh. Welcome to you both. Dr. Pearce, first, can you just tell us, I mean, how much technology is there in a hospital already, and what are the shortcomings?
Good morning. There's a huge amount of technology already embedded across the NHS, from GP surgeries to hospitals. All of our x-rays that when I started in medicine, you'd put a big plastic film on a light box on the wall, are now available to us on computers. Ultrasound scans, all our blood test results, pathology results, all of the notes that we take are now typed onto computer systems. And in the hospital I work in, we can actually access GP records and GP prescribing records from our local GP surgeries for our patients. And we actually prescribe our drugs on electronic systems as well. So they're incredibly complex, with inputs from a really wide range of sources. And they're probably one of the most complex IT systems you'll find anywhere, I would think.
Oh, it sounds like there's no problem at all. It sounds like we've got a fully functioning digital nervous system in our... What are the shortcomings?
Well, because these systems are very complex, and because hospitals have traditionally been used to tailoring their systems to the needs of their own doctors and nurses locally, it's very difficult to get them to communicate with each other. And if you move from hospital to hospital, as our junior doctor colleagues do, they'll tell you that systems differ quite widely between hospitals, which is one of the reasons we have challenges with them talking to each other. And patients these days will often have care shared across multiple hospitals and multiple NHS trusts. If you have complex cancer care, you may have your diagnosis made in one NHS trust, some of your scans and tests in another, and your surgery in a third. And it makes it very difficult for these systems to talk to each other. Mm. Also, the systems themselves, a lot of doctors and nurses find quite frustrating to use, quite challenging to use. They're very, very difficult to design in a user-friendly way that makes them safe and secure. And you've heard in the news and in recent months of how catastrophic it is when a hospital's computer system goes down, how much impact it has on patient care. So all of these systems need to be super secure and super safe and never fail.
Yeah.
And that's a really big ask.
Professor Andrew Morris from the University of Edinburgh, it sounds like there's quite a bit of tech in hospitals at the moment, but it's not very joined up. What's the challenge?
Yeah, to echo Dr. Pearce, and also to echo what Lord Darzi has recommended, this is really important for the NHS. If one looks at all highly performing health systems internationally, they have common characteristics, and many of them resonate with what Lord Darzi said in terms of focus on quality of care, a very strong primary care, strong financial and clinical leadership. But they have two other characteristics. Firstly, whole system intelligence and a very strong research capability. And it's the opportunity now to focus on that whole system intelligence. To echo Dr. Pearce, the ability to follow and track journeys of care, following patients across primary, secondary and tertiary care and social care in real time. Mm. And if we do that, we will enhance patient care, but also enable us to perform population health stratification, address NHS productivity, and also augment clinical trials and perform really quite a unique global platform for research.
I just wonder whether the problem is, or the challenge is that the NHS is struggling to keep up with what its current workload, and there's a massive backlog. To invest in a new IT system and to do all these things, you need a little bit of time out, don't you? Which you just don't have. You can't run these things in parallel when you're already struggling to keep the show on the road.
I'd agree, but at the moment it's like driving at night with no headlights. We need to invest to save. And as Dr. Pierce says, there are examples of great practice across the UK. We have strong clinical and technology leadership, but we need to invest to make it systematic rather than piecemeal.
Right. Dr. Pierce, is that the problem? I mean, is that your experience, that the NHS is so busy fighting the fires of today that it's hard to think about longer-term solutions?
I mean, that's been the situation with the NHS for a long time. It's very, very difficult when attention is on, you know, a huge backlog in your emergency department or having to cancel people awaiting cancer surgery. Those are huge problems for patients right now today. And to take your focus off them to think about planning for tomorrow is very, very difficult. And post-pandemic, it's just been a really, really difficult run getting the NHS back to where it was beforehand. Mm. Dealing with that massive backlog as well as planning for the future. It's a tough challenge for NHS leaders.
And very briefly, Professor Morris, I mean, can things like AI, technological advances, can they save the NHS, get us back on track?
It'll be a vital tool in enabling a high quality health system for all. One has to recall that the feedstock of AI is data. So we need to sort the data in a trustworthy way with public engagement to deliver the high quality services that the NHS is capable of.
Professor Morris from the University of Edinburgh and Dr. Pierce from Professor of Intensive Care at Queen Mary Hospital, University of London. Thank you very much indeed.
Almost 2 minutes to eight time for the weather this morning from Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Nick. Well, it's quite a chilly start to the day, particularly for central and southern areas, but gradually through the weekend, temperatures will be on the rise. So it's going to be warming up. Not completely dry, though. Low pressure will bring outbreaks of rain and windy conditions in the north. So for parts of southern England, the Midlands and eastern England, beautiful start to the day. Clear blue skies. It's going to stick that way through the course of the day. Top temperatures 18 to 20 degrees. That should feel quite pleasant with those light winds around too. Into Wales and northern England, well, here we've got a little bit more cloud this morning, but it should tend to break up. A few spots of drizzly rain too, especially for the northwest of England, but they should clear away. So brightening up, sunny spells, turning quite breezy with highs around about 17 to 19. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, lastly, and a cloudy start to the day with some light patchy drizzly rain. The rain eases for a time, but later in the afternoon we'll see more persistent rain working its way gradually from west to east. I think eastern Scotland should see some dry weather holding on into the afternoon, though. 16 to 18 the highs here. Overnight, rain will clear away from Scotland and Northern Ireland, but it will affect parts of Northern England, North Wales too. Elsewhere, looking dry tonight, still quite chilly in the south, but not as cold as it's been, and some more sunny spells into tomorrow. That's the weather.
These stories demonstrate the best of short fiction around at the moment.
The BBC National Short Story Award 2024. Judged by panellists including Michael Doncourt and Di Spears.
The power of the short story remains really exciting for me.
The finalists have been announced and now you can hear them for yourself every weekday afternoon this week at 3:30.
It's fresh, funny, inventive.
And I think listeners will find lots to enjoy in them.
The BBC National Short Story Award with Cambridge University on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday the 14th of September. The headlines this morning: talks in Washington between Sir Keir Starmer and President Biden have ended with no public change to their policy of stopping Ukraine's use of long-range Western missiles against Russia. We'll speak live to our political editor who's just got off the Prime Minister's plane and to the former Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace. More than 750,000 pensioners in England and Wales are set to lose their winter fuel allowance because they're not expected to apply for benefits they're entitled to. That's according to the government's own analysis. And 35,000 pupils at one of England's largest school academy trusts will be banned from using their smartphones during the school day.
Also coming up this hour, one of the biggest names on Wall Street tells us about his fears for US democracy.
you have a situation where you have irreconcilable differences. There's a possibility that the loser, you know, particularly if it's the Republicans and Donald Trump, might not accept losing.
And? We discuss how David Bowie reinvented himself in 1970s Berlin.
Good morning from Mike Williams with the Saturday Sport. Europe's golfers have given themselves an uphill task of defending their title after a nightmare first day at the Solheim Cup in Virginia. England's cricketers level their T20 series with Australia after victory in Cardiff last night. Meanwhile, ahead of the North London derby in the Premier League this weekend, we have an extended chat with David Pleat looking back on his 65 years in football.
That is all after the BBC News, read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
Sir Keir Starmer says he held wide-ranging and productive talks with President Biden about Ukraine, but wouldn't say whether he'd persuaded the US to allow Kiev to fire Western missiles into Russia. The Prime Minister said the talks at the White House concentrated on strategy rather than a particular step or tactic. Joe Biden said it was clear that Putin would not prevail. But Ukraine's President Zelensky urged the West not to put off a decision about long-range weapons, saying Russian missiles and drones continue to terrorise Ukraine's skies. Our political editor Chris Mason travelled with the Prime Minister to the White House.
This was a meeting at which Ukraine dominated. The Prime Minister and his team had spent the hours before in a secure room at the UK Embassy in conversation with British teams in Ukraine and Russia. President Zelensky still desperate for ongoing help, his allies weighing up how best to provide it and at what cost. The UK has been forward-facing, as it was put to me, in making the case to others to agree to Kyiv's request to be allowed to fire Western missiles into Russia. President Biden is sceptical, fearful it could drag America and Europe into direct conflict with Moscow. There was little expectation this meeting would resolve the issue, not least because further conversations with others at the United Nations are expected shortly. Defeating Russia while not provoking Moscow, the essence of the West's challenge since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2.5 years ago.
The former US Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, Kurt Volker, told us any change in policy towards long-range weapons might not be made public.
They don't want to make a big announcement out of this because it then gives the US and UK a sense of more ownership of attacks inside Russia. And they're desperately trying to avoid the appearance of this being a Western war against Russia, US war against Russia. It just may be that it starts to happen in an incremental way without any kind of announcement.
NATO's highest military authority, the alliance's military committee, is meeting in the Czech capital Prague, where it's discussing greater support for Ukraine. Many Central and Eastern European states have been outspoken supporters of Kyiv and crucial in persuading the alliance to take a strong stance against Moscow. In his opening remarks, the chair of the military committee, Admiral Rob Bauer, called for allies to spend more on defence production.
While it might be the military that wins battles, it's the economy that wins wars. The more we coordinate our defense production, the more we ramp up our deterrence. The more we ramp up our deterrence, the better chance we have of protecting the freedoms that we hold dear and preventing war from ever entering our soil.
New analysis from the Department for Work and Pensions suggests people over 80 will lose out the most under the government's plans to cut winter fuel support for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. 7 out of 10 pensioners with a disability would also lose the payment. The Conservatives said the assessment was shocking. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has been studying the document.
The government has been criticised by opposition parties for not producing a full assessment of the impact of the winter fuel payment cuts on the health and well-being of older people. But the Department for Work and Pensions has released a more limited equalities analysis, which considers the likely impact on different groups of pensioners. It suggests that around 100,000 more people could be persuaded to claim pension credit and therefore retain the winter fuel payment. But more than 750,000 pensioners who are eligible are still not expected to submit a claim and would therefore lose the payment. The analysis also suggests that the over 80s would lose the most financially. A Treasury spokesman said more than a million pensioners would still receive the payment this winter, and the focus was now on ensuring that those who should be claiming it would receive it.
One of England's largest school academy trusts is set to become the first of its size to ban students from using mobile phones at school. Ormiston Academies Trust says it's begun phasing out access to smartphones at its 44 state schools across the country after the Department for Education issued updated advice giving schools in England greater options to ban or restrict the devices. Our correspondent Vincent McAvinney has more.
Ormiston Academies Trust, which educates around 35,000 pupils across the country, says it has begun removing access to smartphones across its 12 primary and 32 state secondary schools. Tom Rees, the Academy's chief executive, says smartphones have disrupted students' learning and their well-being. In particular, he says social media is causing huge issues with mental health. Technology Secretary Peter Kyle has told the BBC he's looking very closely at the impact of an Australian ban on social media for all under-16s.
The former chief executive of Abercrombie and Fitch and his British partner are facing more allegations they sexually exploited men at events they hosted around the world. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith are already defending a civil lawsuit alleging they ran a sex trafficking operation. Last year, the BBC revealed a middleman had been tasked with finding men for these events. Here's our investigations correspondent, Rhianna Croxford.
The BBC has now spoken to 20 men who say they attended or helped organise sex events for Mike Jeffries. These took place from 2009 until 2015, while he was chief executive of Abercrombie & Fitch. The new allegations come from men who say they felt exploited and abused. The FBI has been investigating since the BBC first revealed allegations against Mr. Jeffries last year. He is already facing a civil lawsuit over allegations of sex trafficking. A lawyer for Mr. Jeffries, who retired in 2014, has previously said he denied allegations of wrongdoing. Mr. Smith has never responded to requests for comment.
The Ugandan Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei, who was killed by a former boyfriend earlier this month, will be buried this morning in her family's hometown in eastern Uganda. She'll receive full military honours, having been a member of the Ugandan Armed Forces. The 33-year-old marathon runner, who competed in the Paris Games this year, died after being doused with petrol and set alight. Her attacker also died from injuries sustained in the attack. The Liberal Democrats conference is getting underway in Brighton this morning, where the party will come together for the first time since winning 72 seats in Parliament. Health and social care is on the agenda, as our political correspondent Hannah Miller reports.
The Liberal Democrats say that being the third party in Parliament is a big responsibility and brings with it a far greater ability to affect change. But their record-breaking results in the general election were achieved by pitching themselves in opposition to the Conservatives, raising the question of what the party does now that Labour is in government. As their conference gets underway, the Lib Dems say they want to be a constructive opposition, pointing to their criticism of the government's decision to means test the winter fuel payment as a recent example. With health and social care due to be the focus of debate this afternoon, they will claim to be the party of the NHS and care in every part of Britain.
Two NASA astronauts, whose eight-day mission is now set to last 8 months because of technical problems, have admitted they faced tough times. Barry Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams couldn't use the Boeing Starliner capsule to return from the International Space Station last week because it developed a malfunction. During a news conference, Butch Wilmore insisted they didn't feel let down, even though they now won't be able to come back until February.
We found some things that we just could not get comfortable with. We could have gotten to the point, I believe, where we could have returned on Starliner, but we just simply ran out of time.
Strictly Come Dancing returns tonight, with 15 celebrities hitting the dance floor as the contest enters its 20th year. But the show's faced a rocky few months, with a number of former contestants making allegations about the way they were treated. The BBC has responded to complaints by introducing new welfare measures. Our culture reporter Noor Nanji has more.
Strictly, with its bright lights, sparkles and sequins, is back. New contestants include the TV presenter Nick Knowles, Olympic gold medalist swimmer Tom Dean, and the former Love Islander Tasha Gourie. At tonight's launch show, which professional dancer they've been paired with will be revealed. But the new series follows a storm of controversy, with several celebrities speaking out about their experiences on the show. An investigation launched by the BBC following Amanda Abington's claims about her former dance partner, Giovanni Panice, will reportedly conclude soon. He has denied any allegations of abusive or threatening behaviour. New welfare measures have been put in place, including putting chaperones in all rehearsal rooms.
Nonanji reporting.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It's now 11 minutes past eight. They met for 2 hours at the White House, but at the end of the Prime Minister's much-hyped talks with President Biden, the news that emerged was there is no change to our policy. No change, that is, to the policy that Ukraine cannot use US and UK long-range missiles, including the British-made Storm Shadow, to reach targets inside Russia. This despite the public cry of frustration from Ukraine's President Zelensky, who wrote before the meeting, "When we ask for these systems, we repeatedly hear we're working on it. Time passes, but Russian missiles and Iranian drones continue to terrorise our skies and our people." After leaving the Oval Office, the Prime Minister sought to play down the idea that his meeting should be judged by whether that decision had been taken.
We've had a long and productive discussion on a number of fronts, including Ukraine, as you'd expect, the Middle East and the Indo-Pacific. Talking strategically about tactical decisions, this isn't about a particular decision, and we'll obviously pick up again in Unger in just a few days' time with a wider group of individuals.
Unger is the UN General Assembly. It's in New York. Chris Mason will be there, no doubt. He was with the Prime Minister in the Oval Office and, well, not for the whole meeting, Chris, but is now back and has just got off the Prime Minister's plane. Morning to you.
Morning.
Does no change mean no change, or does it just mean we're not telling you for now?
I think it means we're not telling you for now. So I was told, Nick, even prior to us setting off, with a splash of expectation management from someone in Whitehall, this is not about deliverables, which is a horrible sentence to try and argue that, look, there won't be a big announcement up in lights quite yet. Why? Well, because there'll probably never be a big announcement up in lights, because words matter, as the last few days have proven in the context of all of this in terms of provocation. The first one likely to know that one of these missiles has been deployed into Russia might be after it has been fired. But on top of that, there's further conversations to have. So at the UN General Assembly, this annual gathering of world leaders in New York, that's the week after next, I think there'll be some more conversations. Prime Minister's going to Italy as well tomorrow. Italy currently holds the rotating presidency of the G7 group of countries. So more diplomacy to come. I think we're edging along towards an agreement. President Biden is sceptical. I think they're trying to find a way where they can all accommodate themselves under some sort of very broad umbrella of agreement, even if America's involvement in this next step might be a little more limited. But their technology, their satellites, their know-how is involved, and there is obviously that concern in the White House about the prospect of how Russia might respond.
The meeting was with President Biden. Was it really about what might happen if President Trump returns to the Oval Office, preparing for the possibility of that?
Without question, yes. I mean, you know, the questions that we put to the Prime Minister seems are the ones you would think of. Hang on a minute, why are you charging across the Atlantic at breakneck speed to meet effectively a lame duck president who's got 4 months to go? Should you not be building up relationships with people with whom you might have a relationship that could go on for years? And the argument was, it's about decisions now. Yes, they want to get to a decision on these missiles in the coming weeks or months, but also they are so conscious the prospect of a second term for President Trump. He said in that debate, didn't he, just the other night, when asked about the war in Ukraine and whether he wanted Ukraine to win, well, he didn't offer a direct answer. So the prospect of a massive potential shift in US foreign policy is potentially just around the corner. And clearly, and it's not just the UK here, a desire to put as many things in place prior to that to try and support Ukraine as much as is possible.
Chris Mason, thank you. Off you go. Get some sleep now. Ben Wallace is listening to that, a former British Army officer, of course, who served as Secretary of State for Defence. Good morning to you, Mr. Wallace. You disappointed by this?
I'm just disappointed that it's yet again another tug of war around another capability. It goes on and on. It started with anti-tank missiles, then anti-air missiles, then tanks. Remember the sort of German debacle over, I won't send any tanks, we sent tanks, and the Americans sent tanks. And then we all ended up with Storm Shadow. And all of that delay, all of that tug of war favors Russia. That allows Putin to insert in the delay threats and new red lines and efforts to divide and rule in the international community. And at the end, we all know where we're going to get to. And ultimately, the people who are suffering are those young, Ukrainians of all ages fighting for their freedom and in fact, Europe's freedom.
When you say we all know where we're going to get to, is that bitter experience that whether it was a row about HIMARS artilleries or M1 tanks or F-16s, you think that President Biden will eventually agree?
Yes, I think he will in the end. I'm not sure about ATACMS, but, you know...
Just to be clear what those are the American equivalent, is that right? Are the Storm Shadow...
Well, they're ground-launched long-range strike weapons from units on the ground predominantly, whereas the Storm Shadows are obviously launched from aircraft. So, but they have the same effect. And, you know, according to the Institute of War Studies, there's about 245 Russian targets within their range over the border that are prosecuting the war on Ukraine. That's air defense, that's airfields. There are 16 airfields, signals intelligence, electronic warfare, all the things that are allowing Russia to do what it is doing, both on its advance, but also potentially in the areas it's got its own problems. And, you know, if we sit around and do nothing, that is what we will see. We will see a greater support Russian military operations in Ukraine.
I
thought everyone wanted Ukraine to win.
Are you saying that we shouldn't take Putin's threat seriously? We heard him say this week that the consequences will be such as you've never seen in your entire history. Now, even if you think those are words, he's not going to use tactical nuclear weapons, there are all sorts of other things he might do, aren't they? He could sabotage undersea cables. He could help the Houthis target our oil. He could, in other words, try and bring the war to the West in ways that we don't like in retaliation.
Yeah, he could even use nerve agent in Britain. Oh, no, he's done that already. And he's already tried through the GRU to set fire to some warehouses in London in May this year, and he's already tried across Europe. Russia has been prosecuting sub-threshold, or whatever you want to call it, attacks on the West for years, whether it's cyber, whether it's the use of proxies, whether it's corruption, political interference, and indeed efforts, you know, such as nerve agents in Salisbury way before the invasion. So I think... You know, Putin has spent, like the bully he is, he has spent the last few years threatening a range of reprisals with either sort of dramatic language or just, daily, you know, people on talk shows repeating Kremlin lines. He has used this all the time. Everything was a red line. Tanks were supposed to be a red line. Fighter jets were supposed to be a red line. He's a bully. And for a bully to succeed, all he needs to do is intimidate people. All he needs to do is get people to pause, and as your former US-Ukrainian negotiator said earlier, you know, that's how he gets us to change our behavior. Look, none of these weapons that we're talking about, ATACMS or Storm Shadow, could go anywhere near Moscow. We're talking of weapons of, you know, at most 500-kilometer range, and none of them could go into the heart of Russia. The Ukrainians are doing very well with their own weapon systems on that. But these could all target the military targets over the border in Russia that are fundamentally, under international law, allowed to be targeted. And I think it's really important. You know, do we want Ukraine to win and Russia to fail in Ukraine? Yes, we do. I understand that is consistently the policy of both the last government and this government in the United Kingdom.
But it may not be the policy of the next American government. President Trump, when asked that in the debate, did not answer, as we heard. His vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, made comments yesterday that if Trump won, he would sit both sides down and said, you guys need to figure out what does a peaceful settlement look like. And according to Vance, it looks very much like where we are now on the ground, with the Russians keeping the territory they've gained.
Well, you know, I... I think that's the new world we're in, right? Which is, where is the United States in a whole range of issues? And one of the ways that the United Kingdom and Europe as well can insulate itself from potentially unpredictable Trump-type policies is to invest in its own deterrence and security and capability. So we don't have to constantly rely on getting permission for our own missiles, by the way, in some cases. We have to be able to always have, in the self-defense of our allies in Europe and indeed in the United Kingdom, that ability to operate in a new landscape where, you know, we are not all in it together in the same way we used to. I was the Secretary of State during Afghanistan. And we remember that sort of Trump deal on Afghanistan. It couldn't have handed the Taliban even more quickly a victory. And then, indeed, President Biden at the time removed any of the conditions to go with it. And, you know, some of those ripples from Afghanistan, from the lack of the West resolve, from a perception that the United States was going to go into a world of isolationism, have been felt today. And there'll be no doubt that people in the likes of the Hamas regime and indeed elsewhere in the world spotted that resolve, questioned that resolve. And here's the irony. President Trump is always, always on the offensive towards China. This matters. The resolve of the United States and her allies and NATO on Ukraine matters because it is China that is watching, and the United States should take heed from that. I know many in the Biden administration does. Blinken, he gets it. And I know President Biden, in the end, often gets to that position. But there are others who don't. And I think it's really important that the West demonstrates its resolve from start to end.
Ben Wallace.
And we help Ukraine win.
We have to leave it there. But Ben Wallace, former Secretary of State for Defence, thank you very much for joining us.
It's just gone 22 minutes past eight. Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, The Thin White Duke, David Bowie had gone through a number of incarnations by the mid-1970s, and it had taken a heavy toll on Bowie himself. Addicted to cocaine, reportedly broke, he fled to Berlin, where he recorded this. Well, it seems that the experience of living in a city at the front of the Cold War seems to have done him a power of good. From a new documentary, here's David Bowie speaking in 2002 to Mojo magazine.
I like the idea of the wall as well, because at that time I felt it was always necessary to be in a place where there was tension. And you couldn't find a place with more tension than living in West Berlin. It was just a tremendous place to be. I can see why throughout this century it's been the one place that writers have continually returned to, because both the negative and positive aspects of whatever's going to happen in Europe kind of always emanate at some point, right from the 20s, from Berlin.
Well, that documentary, Bowie in Berlin, airs tonight, and Francis Whateley wrote and produced it. We can also speak to Victoria Brokes, co-curator of the David Bowie exhibition back in 2013 with Geoffrey Marsh and director of the London Design Biennale. Good morning to you all. Francis, first of all, if I wanted to get over drug addiction, I can think of better things to do than moving in with Iggy Pop to a flat in Berlin.
I think you can. Berlin at the time was not only the centre of the Cold War, it was also the heroin capital of the world. So an unlikely choice. I mean, for Bowie to move from LA, from the warmth of LA, to the cold greyness of Berlin seems an extraordinary choice, and not something you can imagine, I don't know, Mick Jagger or Bob Dylan or Elton John doing. Right. Absolutely remarkable.
And yet was a tonic for his creativity.
Absolutely. I think he used the city as a sort of sanatorium, you know, arriving sort of drug-addled and leaving drug-free, having experienced the city and everything it had to offer, mostly for him, the benefit of anonymity.
Yeah. I always think of Low as that the period of that. It was a very different sound from him that emanated after this.
I think when you mention Low, it's part of the sort of Bowie myth of Berlin and the Bowie trilogy of albums, the Berlin trilogy, as it's called, and it's just a misnomer. You know, Low was recorded and produced really mostly in outside Paris and was finished off in Berlin, and Lodger, the third of the three albums, was made in Switzerland. So it was only actually Heroes that was made in actually in Berlin.
Interesting. Victoria Brokes, co-creator of the Bowie exhibition. What did you make of this period? Good morning. How did you represent this period in your exhibition?
Well, we saw it as, of course, as a crucial period in Bowie's development. And, you know, he'd been performing since the early 60s without, you know, being much taken note of, and then had this massive success in the early 70s. And going to Berlin was a really radical thing to do. And allowed him to reinvent himself as an artist. You know, I think we all know Berlin then was a very, very different place to what it is now. And one simply can't think, as Francis said, of anyone going, well, you know, of going to live there as a sort of fun place. It was really a challenging place for him to go.
But it's always had this industrial cool about it, hasn't it? Even back in the 1920s, it had a certain sort of, you know, it had a certain atmosphere to it.
And Bowie was very attracted to the Weimar Republic and Bowie of the Berlin of the 1920s. But he was also, throughout his career, had a real commitment to developing himself as an artist. And I think if he hadn't gone there, got away from it all, we'd have a very different view of him now.
And Francis, what are you trying to get out of this? What do we need to understand? Was this kind of some kind of transmogrification where he went in as one thing and came out as a different butterfly?
I think he did. And I worked on this with John Wilson, who's normally the presenter. And so I became the presenter and he actually became my producer. And we sort of came up with this idea of having three important women in his life at that time to sort of tell the story and to tell the story of how he became not another character, but I think he became himself. Mm. So David Bowie reinvented himself as David Jones. Yeah. And the three women were all remarkable. There's one, Claire Shenstone, who was an artist, and Francis Bacon and Dennis Potter's muse, who came over many times to Berlin to see him.
She describes herself as a sort of rock that he could crawl out of the water onto for occasionally.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, he knew her from the late 60s. Mm. And she is, in the documentary, we suggest that she was very much the inspiration for that song you played earlier, Heroes.
Okay, got it. And Victoria, you met David Bowie during that period when the exhibition was on. Did he have any reflections on that period? I mean, what was it like meeting him? What he thought of that exhibition?
Well, it was, of course, amazing meeting him. And the stranger thing, perhaps, was that we did not meet him while we were working very closely with his team on the exhibition. But he came and brought his family. And I think he was, he said he thought it was awesome.
You'd have to be a bit po-faced to say, I don't like the exhibition you put on about me.
He spent a couple of hours in it. I think probably he started off thinking, oh, I know all this, it's all my stuff. But as he went around the exhibition, he saw a difference. I mean, one of the things we had in the Berlin section in the exhibition was actually seven different versions of Heroes, following how it had gone from really quite a sedate performance when it was released in 1977 through to becoming a kind of world
stadium
anthem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Victoria Brokes, co-curator of the Bowie exhibition back in 2013, and Francis Whateley, who's written and produced Bowie in Berlin, which airs tonight on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Thank you both. Thank you very much.
Sounds like it'll be a treat. 29 minutes past eight, always a treat with Mike Williams. Weekend sports news. Morning, Mike.
Yes, morning, Nick. Speaking of Bowie, who will be the star man in the North London Derby tomorrow? You like that one? Yeah, that one's just
not
for
as
you.
Good as my earlier one.
Your one was better, yeah. I bow to you, to your superiority there. But the bit that is the North London Derby, without question, the biggest match this weekend as the Premier League returns, and ahead of Tottenham against Arsenal, we're going to hear now from one of the great games, one of the great names, not just of Spurs, but in English football altogether. David Pleat will celebrate his 80th birthday in January and has released a new book looking back on his 65 years in football. So much to talk to David about, but he began by taking me back to where it all began, the first ever match he ever attended as an 8-year-old on Christmas Day 1953.
Well, there were no buses then on Christmas Day, and everyone was walking to the ground, and some walked many miles. Nottingham Forest, which was my hometown, they beat Leeds United. They didn't play in white shirts then. They played in gold and blue. The great John Charles scored two goals, but Forest won 4-2. And the following day, believe it or not, Boxing Day at Leeds, Forest won again, but that's when my first, perhaps inspiration, you may call it, to love the beautiful game began. I was encaptured.
Something that struck me reading the book is where you say that in football and in life generally, you learn much more when you face adversity than when you taste success. What would you say have been the most challenging times in your career?
Oh, I've had several challenging times. I had a period at Luton when the chairman was very difficult and I had to tolerate one or two difficult moments. Losing a semi-final in the last minute at Villa Park was a difficult moment to come back from. Just a losing promotion by a fraction of a goal in that era. But fortunately, the following year, from that adversity, we won the championship by a mile. So that's the kind of adversity that you benefit from in a way. You know, everyone has to be stronger after they have a knockback.
You mentioned winning the championship with Luton. What are the other highlights or notable successes of your career as you look back on it now?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I'm proudest about is the amount of players who I had, where so many of the players then advanced, not only to be England internationals, like Mick Harford, Paul Walsh, Brian Steen. They weren't capped when they came to Luton. And they got caps, international caps. And in time, some of those players emerged to be managers and leaders. And that was very important. People like Radi Antic, who managed Real Madrid and Barcelona.
You mentioned Radi Antic. No interview with David Plea, particularly one looking back on his life, it is complete without mentioning that game at Main Road, that winner that kept Luton up and saw you dance a jig of delight as you skipped across the field at the full-time whistle.
And that's it!
That was an emotional moment, and had we gone down and lost that game at Manchester City, all those years of hard work would have been lost. Evidently, I had very light-coloured shoes on. They went to the Luton Academy, £4,000 that raised for the Luton Academy. Where the suit went, I don't know.
It's a collector's item for sure, wherever it is, a piece of footballing folklore. One of your most recent jobs has been a scout for Tottenham. What do you say to those who say that scouting players, that the future stars these days, is all about data and statistics and analytics?
No, it's not all about data and analytics, and I've tried to make that clear. Data and analytics enhances the watching of players, the eye and the ears. You learn things when you go to other clubs, people talk, you find out who they may have in their underbelly, who's a very promising young player, possibly. There is all sorts of things that an analyst may not see. He may not see if the player is popular with players, his other players, his own players. They may not see or hear that he's an arrogant figure, perhaps, in the dressing room. They certainly haven't got data on 11 and 12-year-olds, where now, unfortunately, in football, that is where all the agents are looking and all the clubs are looking, at a very, very young age. We have to realise that different eras a change and the game is advancing. But your question is very clear. Data can help and support the eye and the ears.
Could have spoken to David Pleat for hours. Indeed, we did speak for about 40 minutes last night. He had to go. In fact, he was attending Gary Richardson's leaving do last night. Yeah, he was there, but we had a great chat. And actually, whilst he was waiting to head down to the reception at Broadcasting House last night, we were trying to kill a bit of time. So I just thought I'd throw some quick fire questions at him. You know, the sort of tea or coffee kind of thing. So this is I'll quickly play this bit of fun for Saturday morning. I started with a very tough one for any Spurs fan. This is to David Pleat. Harry Kane or Jimmy Greaves?
Ooh, too difficult to answer. Jimmy, they were different types of players. I'm going to take the easy way out. Greaves was wonderful. He glided past people, placed the ball in the net. He was brilliant. He was quick. He was brainy. Kane's worked very hard at his game to get where he has. And he's a wonderful centre-forward who can play both deep and up front. Almost equal. I'm sorry. I'm on the fence.
A politician's answer, dare I say, David. Pep Guardiola or Brian Clough?
Brian Clough.
Bill Nicholson or Alex Ferguson?
Bill Nicholson.
The old White Hart Lane or the brand new world-beating Tottenham Hotspur Stadium?
Oh, my word. Great legacy to Daniel Levy and the board to get a wonderful training ground and a wonderful stadium. So although the old White Hart Lane has many wonderful memories for many supporters, I've got to say the new stadium is absolutely fantastic.
And last one of these. Spurs win the league or England win the next World Cup?
Oh, dear, 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 dear. Oh, dear. England need to win the World Cup.
is the correct answer from David. I think so. David, please book. Just One More Goal is out now.
Thanks very much, Mike. After the 9 o'clock, here's Saturday Live. Nikki Bailey's telling us about it.
Our guests on today's show are the man responsible for our obsession with Middle Eastern flavours and spices, Yotam Ottolenghi. Livy Dean will be sharing her story about the grief she felt at losing an eye to cancer and her subsequent resilience and positivity. We welcome historian siblings David and Yinka Olusoga. They've written a superb book and will be sharing some of their own life stories. All that, plus we have the inheritance tracks of comedian and creator of Keith Lemon, Lee Francis. If you want to be in touch with us, email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk, and we look forward to your company just after the news at 9.
Thanks, Nikki. Quick look at the weather now. This morning will turn mostly dry for a time, with variable cloud in the north and sunshine in the south. In the afternoon, though, a band of rain will move across the northwest.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Simon Jack, and at 25 to 9, Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer says he's held a long and productive discussion with President Biden about Ukraine, but wouldn't be drawn as to whether he'd persuaded the US to allow Kyiv to fire long-range Western missiles into Russian territory. The former Defence Secretary and British Army officer Ben Wallace told us the meeting was disappointing and was another delay which favoured Russia. New analysis from the Department for Work and Pensions suggests people over 80 will lose out the most under the government's plans to cut winter fuel support for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. 7 out of 10 pensioners with a disability would also lose the payment. One of England's largest school academy trusts is set to become the first of its size to ban students from using mobile phones at school. Ormiston Academies Trust says it's phasing out access to smartphones for around 35,000 pupils at its 44 state schools. More men have come forward to the BBC accusing the former chief executive of Abercrombie and Fitch and his British partner of sexual exploitation. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith are already defending a civil lawsuit alleging they ran a sex trafficking operation.
Thanks, Chris. A billionaire investor who predicted and made a fortune from the global financial crisis has warned that the US is on the brink of serious civil disorder. In a week when candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump finally faced each other in a televised debate, Ray Dalio, founder of the world's biggest hedge fund, the $124 billion Bridgewater Associates, says he has grave fears for democracy in the US and internationally. I asked him why we should listen to a money man making big profits. Don't make you a prophet, do they?
You know, I started investing when I was 12, so there's a learning experiences. And along the way, I learned two things that I guess you might call the Dalio or the Bridgewater formula, since I formed Bridgewater. The first was that I got in the habit of writing down my criteria, which I call my principles, and then back testing them over periods of time so that I would create decision rules and systems. And then I quantified that and that I computerized that. So I would go back and study history, global history. So, for example, studying the Great Depression, and particularly the 1933 when interest rates hit zero, allowed me to anticipate the 2008 financial crisis. So I'd say writing down the principles and systemizing the decision-making into a decision-making system that is been timeless and universally tested, and then with a long history.
Now, you've talked about, let's talk about internal disorder in the United States, you've talked about the potential for civil war. Do you mean that?
You have a situation where you have irreconcilable differences. There's a possibility that the loser, you know, particularly if it's the Republicans and Donald Trump, might not accept losing. And you have a situation where it's a win at all cost by both the left and the right. So neither side can compromise. So you have a dynamic which is a particularly risky dynamic. There will be two things to pay attention to. First, can you have an orderly transition? We will find that out quickly. And then after the orderly transition, you have a dysfunctional government in which there's going to be very hard playing against each other That will be challenging. I think you're seeing now, and you're going to see more of it, people moving to different states because the states represent different living standards, different approaches. And so I think you're seeing more of a fragmentation, a serious conflict between the parties that's affecting government.
So just spell that out. You're talking about Republicans who live in New York moving to, I don't know, Texas, and Democrats who live in Texas moving to, you know, actually sort of migration within the United States?
Yeah. There's a lot of people in states like California and New York and New Jersey and so on who will go to states like Florida and Texas, partially because of taxes, but partially because of values.
And would you make a parallel with any other period in your study of hundreds of years of history? Where are we? What does this remind you of, where we are now?
This reminds me of the 1930 to 45 period in which there was an economic problem, economic crisis, and then four democracies chose to be dictatorships. Germany, Italy, Spain, and Japan had parliamentary systems, and they broke down in terms of internal conflict between the hard left, the hard right, communism and fascism. We are today seeing modern day versions of some of these things.
That 33 period onwards led to a world war. Do you think that's a possibility with the fractiousness we see in the globe today?
Of course it's a possibility. I think, though, that we're in a situation in which MAD, mutually assured destruction, is something that is creating a great deal of hesitation. And I expect or hope that the issue of war nowadays, as we have experienced military war, I think that the probabilities of that are low, but cannot be dismissed. So because the probabilities are low, largely, I think, because of the consequences.
And a few either or questions, binary answers only, please, Ray. Gold or Bitcoin?
Gold.
Dollar or renminbi?
Dollar.
Trump or Harris?
No answer.
Okay.
Both bad choices.
That was Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater Associates, which is the world's biggest hedge fund, dodging the only question we really wanted the answer to.
You tried.
Hedging his bets, which is probably enough for a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, it was fascinating. We'll cheer you up, I promise. The problems are coming, you know. That was a fascinating but slightly downbeat conversation. It is 17 minutes to nine now. It's that time of year when thousands of men and women in suits huddle together to listen to politicians speak for hour after hour and day after day. Yes, it is party conference season, and this week is the turn of the Liberal Democrats, now firmly re-established as the UK's third largest party, with 72 MPs in the House of Commons. Joining us from Brighton, where they're having that conference, is the Liberal Democrat Chief Whip, the MP for North East Fife, Wendy Chamberlain. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Now, I will do my attempt to lighten the mood.
Well, we know health is the big focus of the conference today, and we've had this big report, the Darzi report, this week. Do you accept the central argument government is now making that it is not enough to spend more money? Radical reform of the health service is needed.
Yeah, I think we do accept that. And you only have to look to Scotland. Obviously, I'm a Scottish MP, to know that we have an NHS in Scotland that gets more money per head, but actually is producing poorer outcomes. So it's quite clear that more money is not the answer. What we now need to see is, on the back of the Darzi report, what the government bring forward. But what I would say, and what you would expect me to say as a Liberal Democrat, is what was missing from the Darzi report was some real diagnosis around social care. That was very much at the heart of our campaign during the general election. Ed Davey campaigned on it very passionately, and we firmly believe that without tackling the issues in social care, you won't really get to some of the root causes of the issues within the NHS.
You talk ahead of this conference of the great responsibility you now have as a much bigger party, as the third biggest party. Now, when it comes to social care that you say you care about so much, what is the Lib Dems' idea? Establish a cross-party commission to forge a long-term agreement on sustainable funding. Shouldn't we be able to expect more from an opposition party, that you use the freedom you have of not being government to actually come up with the idea?
And I'm sure we will be coming up with ideas, Nick. But what we were saying there when we came into the general election is it doesn't matter what party is in power at Westminster. Social care and the intractable issues around it need to be tackled, and they need to be tackled in a consensual way.
They don't need so another meeting and another commission. They need a solution.
Well, I agree that we do need solutions, but what we need is the right solution. And a variety of things have been brought forward in recent years that don't properly tackle it. We're also not talking about social care, but we're talking about our unpaid carers as well. We know that they are providing billions of pounds in support to their loved ones and others. I brought forward the Carers Leave Act myself in the last Parliament. So I think there are practical solutions that the Liberal Democrats have, but it is quite clear that we need to do more.
Do you accept the conclusions of the Darcy report that many of the problems of the health service were caused by austerity and the reforms the NHS made in 2012? Just remind us who was in government at the time those two policies were pushed through.
Now, obviously, that is talking about the time during the coalition, and it's clear that we need to see more investment in infrastructure when we look at hospitals with RAC.
Do you accept the blame as the Liberal Democrats for those policies that have been criticised this week?
What I would say, Nick, is obviously we were in coalition at that time, but I think you need to look to post-2015 to see that the real damage that has been done to the NHS.
That's not what Darcy says. He blames austerity and he blames the reforms the NHS made when you were in government.
Well, that's obviously talking about coalition, but I think I would also say, in addition to the report, that we look at post-2015 and the failures that the Conservative government made in that time. And they made promises. Boris Johnson talked about his 40 hospitals, and we know that those are not being delivered. Okay. There was only one party in government at that time.
I'm going to leave it there, I'm afraid. Good luck. Enjoy your conference. Many more to come. Wendy Chamberlain there, Liberal Democrat Chief Whip.
13 minutes to nine. Mobile phones have a catastrophic impact on children's ability to learn, focus and concentrate at school. According to the head of an academies trust which runs 44 schools, which is beginning to make its 35,000 pupils go phone-free during the school day. Is that a blueprint that others should follow? Tom Bennett is an advisor to the Department for Education on behavioural policy and has worked with the Ormiston Academy, which is bringing in this ban. Good morning to you, Tom Bennett.
Good morning.
What do you make of this? How significant is this move?
I mean, it's absolutely the right move to do it. Every school should be following suit throughout the UK, primary and secondary. A lot of schools already have mobile phone restrictions. I mean, I think over 90% of schools have got some kind of mobile phone ban, but some schools allow them in social spaces and break time and corridors and playgrounds before and after school and so on. Some schools allow them in the classroom, although that's less common. But what you also get is a lot of schools who've got a ban in place, but they don't often enforce it as thoroughly or as consistently or as frequently as they feel they should, or they don't back teachers when they're asked to, or the parents push back a lot and then exceptions are made. So there's it's a very variegated landscape, but it's very significant that this is such a large academy chain which is enforcing a very strict kind of gate-to-gate ban, or obviously depending on different schools' policies, but by and large that appears to be the main thrust of it.
Just reading some comments from Tom Rees, the chief executive of this trust who's bringing this in The Guardian today. He said it's not just about having your phone out and using it, it's the mere presence of the phone. There's evidence that tells us that even if your phone is in the same room, it could be in your bag or pocket, your brain is leaking attention, still thinking about it and being drawn to it. It's quite a statement.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of research to back this up, that when you've got your phone in your pocket, you know, even if you're not using it, you're thinking, I wonder if somebody's messaging, I wonder if someone's texting me. And that habit, which can form, I mean, I'm a grown-up, and I've got that habit, and I think a lot of grown-ups do too. Children are even more susceptible to this because of peer pressure and social peer pressure. So for children to think, I wonder if I could check my phone, is one of these things that just draws their attention away from what it is that we're trying to do. And in schools, the real estate of someone's attention is very much what we are trying to work with. We're trying to get kids to concentrate and think and focus and converse with one another in practical and purposeful ways. And mobile phones are the exact opposite of that. They're attention hoovers, and they're designed to entertain and distract people.
It's not the phone so much as the software that's on them, right? It's the social media apps that are on there. You helped to write mobile phone guidance, which was presented to government. Mm-hmm. It seems that sort of almost everyone agrees that this should be done. What are the problems? What are the impediments to getting this policy right?
The main problem to it is a kind of a mindset. It's a culture with with some parents, I mean, lots of parents, lots of children, and even, you know, teachers and staff, which is that, oh, it's the 21st century, you know, they've all got phones now, we've just got to roll with it, or it's incredibly hard to ban them, you know, this will be so difficult. But that mindset is the impediment itself, because all it takes is for a concerted effort amongst all adults to decide these kids don't need these phones. They're actually a safeguarding hazard, and they're a teaching and learning hazard. Yeah, but so let's ban them. And once you've decided to do that, and you have the policy and you have the training in place, phones can vanish in about a week, 2 weeks. I mean, I've seen it happen in multiple schools. And best of all, the kids love it once they've got over that initial hurdle of, you know, where's my phone?
Yeah.
And the adults love it. And the parents are very supportive of it once you, again, overcome that kind of hurdle of, oh, this is what they should have and it's really hard not to. And, oh, their friends will mock them if they don't have a phone.
Yeah.
If their friends don't have a phone, then
everyone's
won't
in the same boat. Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll have to leave it there. Tom Bennett, advisor of the Department for Education on Behavioural Policy. Thank you.
9:09. The COVID inquiry reopened this week. It's taking evidence about the impact of the pandemic on the NHS and healthcare. Our health reporter Jim Reid has been following it from the start and brings his reports each Saturday on what we've heard. His report this week starts with the voices of those families most directly affected.
At that time, I still thought they would be able to resuscitate him. I just didn't realise that COVID could be fatal for younger people.
Carol Steele's son, Andrew, was 28 years old with no health problems when he caught COVID. As he got sicker, he called the NHS 24 helpline in Scotland.
He was told to wait another day, and the advisor also said that he was to try and get through things, through his symptoms.
Is it right that at that time you were aware that the local hospital was at full capacity?
Yes, I remember from social media.
The next day, Andrew's girlfriend had to call for an ambulance. The paramedics tried to restart his heart for 20 minutes.
They told us that he'd had a blood clot, a pulmonary embolism, and that it had been caused by COVID, and the damage that it had done was irreversible.
The families of those who lost their lives to COVID were the first to give evidence this week to the inquiry.
Good morning.
Again led by the retired judge, Baroness Hallett.
Today we begin the public hearings into Module 3.
Jacqueline Carey KC, a criminal barrister and now the inquiry's lead counsel, began with a familiar phrase.
Stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives. And the focus of the inquiry's Module 3 hearings will be on some of those words and the ultimate questions. Did we protect the NHS? Did we save lives? And perhaps as importantly, why did we need to protect the NHS and at what cost?
Early in the pandemic, this was the message coming from Boris Johnson.
The single most useful thing that we can all do is to wash our hands 2 times, happy birthday, hot water, and so.
But measures like hand washing and plastic dividers in shops were all based on an assumption that COVID could only be spread on surfaces or in large droplets after a cough or sneeze, for example.
I do solemnly, sincerely...
Clive Beggs, a professor of engineering at Leeds Beckett University, produced a report on this for the inquiry.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
He said it took too long for health authorities to accept the virus could also be spread longer distances as tiny particles suspended in the air.
What I want to try and understand is why that's important.
It's absolutely fundamental.
All right.
Because it's a bit like a house of cards. Once that goes, everything else goes. So it's crucial. That's a crucial and important factor.
To protect against those tiny aerosol particles, you need a tight-fitting respirator mask or hood. But most healthcare workers were told that was not needed and they could wear a basic surgical mask instead.
Good morning, Dr. Jones.
Good morning.
Dr. Barry Jones, a retired physician and chair of the COVID-19 Airborne Transmission Alliance, said that mistake cost lives.
The government said that it was following the science, but instead it followed bad science given to them by those who should have known better.
Later, this inquiry will also look in detail at some of the other decisions made in hospitals.
Sullivan, thank you so much for coming to help.
John Sullivan's adult daughter, Susan, had Down syndrome and was admitted to hospital with COVID.
I appreciate that it's not going to be easy for you, but we're really grateful.
Her medical notes suggest her transfer to intensive care was declined, in part because of her condition.
Dealing with the death of a child is one thing.
But dealing with the death of a child because nobody gave her a chance of life is the hardest thing to deal with. What they did, they gave her a bed to die in. And they gave her a bed to die in because she had Down syndrome.
Next week, the inquiry will start to question some of the health officials involved in the COVID response. Plus, we hear from groups representing nurses and others working on the front line.
Jim Reid reported, it's now 9:05. It's almost over. The festival, which aims to bring the best classical music to the widest possible audience, ends tonight at the last night of the Proms. That is one of Britain's best-loved pianists, Stephen Hough, from yesterday's rehearsal with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, playing the second movement of Sanson's Piano Concerto No. 5 in F major. Just one of the treats for tonight, but it is not any old last night. It's the last night of the last year of the last Proms for the director of the whole festival, David Pickard, who joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
A bittersweet moment for you.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, so many different emotions. So a level of exhaustion, having been through 2 months of concerts and 90 concerts. I've been to them all and they've all been, for me, absolutely amazing. But also, you know, huge honour to have had the opportunity to do this job. I first encountered the Proms, like so many people, as a teenager in the arena, and never ever thought I'd be able to do this particular role.
Now, before the last night, Rob Natick, we all focus on the usual rows about flag waving and, you know, patriotism and so on. Tell us what the new bits that you insert, the bits you've had some fun with.
Well, the last night, as you say, has a sort of fixed point of some amazing communal singing at the end of the Proms, which is very much part of the last night. But every year is slightly different. As you say, we have the wonderful pianist Stephen Hough this year. We have an amazing soloist, Angel Blue. And the sort of holy grail for us is if you get the two soloists to work together. So we have the two of them singing spirituals together, which have been arranged by Stephen himself. So that's a special moment.
And you've tried to add a theme of sports throughout, which includes tonight.
Yes, well, one of our anniversaries this year is the slightly crazy American composer Charles Ives, and one of his craziest pieces is called the Princeton-Yale football game, which is 2 minutes of American football. So we thought, how can we build on that in a rather British way after this amazing summer? So we've got a composer called Ian Farrington, who's managed to stitch together, I think, a total of 8 different sports themes into one wonderful medley, some of them layered on top of each other. So you can have a lot of fun trying to identify what those tunes are. I think some will be very clear and some perhaps a bit less clear.
I slightly dismissively talked about the fuss. The truth is, for some people, that display of patriotism is a crucial part for them of Britain and being British. For others, even great soloists that you've had, it's awkward for them. They're like, it's not fair. If you had to write a note for your successor, what would you tell them?
I think you'd just say, you'll never win. Yeah. Because you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, for everybody that thinks that last night should be sort of blown up and reformed altogether, there are many, many people there who love the traditions. And the truth is that actually when you're in the hall, the spirit of joy amongst people, the spirit of communality of people singing together, is really overwhelming. You know, I this is my 9th last night, and it'll be a very sad occasion for me, but also a joyous one. It always is. It's a celebration at the end of this fantastic music festival.
Yeah, here to that. I've been lucky enough to go a couple of times, and people love that moment, don't they? We perhaps take the whole Proms slightly for granted because it's here every year. As somebody who used to run Global, how special is this globally, this great festival of music?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the word globally, because I think it is respected in this country, but I think you also have to understand it's an international festival. And Simon Rattle, who was here earlier this summer, was saying, you know, you just have to understand how important this is to my orchestra, which is an orchestra coming from Germany, coming to the Proms, and what they feel like at the end of a performance with, you know, 1,000 people standing right close to them in an arena. You know, this amazing atmosphere of silence and concentration in the most fantastic space. It's something that cannot be replicated anywhere else in the world.